Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your never-ending life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrews. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Arc of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. The solar wind is a very mild 454.9 kilometers per second right now. The sun is completely blank today, no sunspots. There is no coronal hole facing Earth right now. There will be a partial solar eclipse visible from Russia, India, China, and northern parts of Alaska tomorrow. It was 99 degrees in Phoenix yesterday, smashing all temperature records, while a northeast snowstorm shut down airports and dumped many inches of snow in a late winter flash. A study suggests the smallest particles in lunar dust might be toxic. if comparisons with dust inhalation cases on Earth apply. Astronaut Harrison H. Schmidt, the last man to step on the moon in Apollo 17, complained of lunar dust hay fever when his dirty spacesuit contaminated with the habitation module after an energetic foray on the lunar surface. They determined that most of the fine particles in lunar dust are composed of glass, formed through the impact of micrometeorites on the surface of the moon. But the glass also contains metallic iron grains, much like that in a carpenter's nail, and measuring just 10 to 20 nanometers in size. That's about a billionth of a meter. These grains, called nanophase iron, are so small that if inhaled, some would pass directly from the lungs into the blood circulation. Once in the blood, the iron could de-energize the hemoglobin molecule, which carries oxygen to the body's tissues. If enough gets dissolved in the blood, it could produce effects similar to carbon monoxide poisoning. Just thought you might like to know that if you're planning a trip to the moon. Next week on X Squared Radio, we will launch the Spirit Race. I know you've heard quite a bit about that on this station, so now we are going to kick it off. Our guest is one of the original architects of Clearing. She is a very private person, but she has agreed to come on the air and discuss what we believe may be the best tool for freeing up the flow of human life force on the planet. Her name is Enid Vienne. If you haven't heard of her, don't worry. You will definitely learn something if you show up next week. We will also have Ken Payne and some special surprise guests as well. Don't miss next week. This week on X Squared Radio, we have a very special guest. He is a filmmaker, lecturer, and best-selling author. He is fast becoming a household name in the new energy and human consciousness world. He has a new book called, I believe, The Singularity, and has a new film called From Here to Andromeda. I have met him in person and felt his energy, and now you're going to feel it right here on X Squared Radio. Please welcome with me David Sarita. How are you, my friend?
Good, Brooks. Just got back from a long trip to Texas, and I'm in the last stages of filming and editing From Here to Andromeda. And, it's really incredible to see, you know, as I started this film about 8 months ago, that there are just all these miracles aligning up, you know, in the process of filming that I didn't expect, but that are consistent with the topic of the film. And it's just kind of magic, you know, as it's all coming together here.
Well, that's awesome. So you were filming this last leg down in Texas?
Well, the last filming was in Dallas, Texas. We met with a senior research scientist who works for one of the top defense contractor in America. I'm not prepared to name his name on the radio, but what we have is probably, you know, what happens typically is as, you know, people who have inside information into UFOs and anti-gravity and, you know, contact from other civilizations, breakthroughs in scientists, when they get to a certain age, while they were sworn to secrecy their whole life, they tend to want to disclose their secrets before they die. I mean, this happened with Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell in his book The Day After Roswell. It's now happening with Paul Hellyer, the former Minister of Defense Canada. And, you know, on and on the list goes. I mean, it happened with Madeleine Brown, who was the mistress to Lyndon Johnson. Just before she died, in a videotape interview, she tells everybody who killed Kennedy. And it's just so typical. And then what we have now is a senior research scientist who believes we have the right to know the truth about UFOs, about, you know, our position on the planet right now, the likelihood that we will not survive the global climate change due to global warming and other environmental problems such as sewage pollution, and on the list goes. And because of the very fact that we are probably not going to survive, when I say probably, I mean that in a sense that I want to motivate people so that we do survive. But when you look at what my film is about, From Here to Andromeda, it's about the emergency and the emergence of climate change that is coming upon us like a tsunami wave. And when you really look at the facts, the real hard data, and we don't turn a blind eye to it, the real truth is even if we met the Kyoto Protocol, which we're not willing to meet in the United States, we're still not going to survive on this planet. We're not going to beat global warming. It's going to beat us. So the question is, how do we transfer the human experience and humanity to another star system and another planet? And what is really shocking is that, firstly, the UFO phenomena is our best hope because our current known sources of propulsion, propelling ourselves through across landmass, over the ocean, into the air mass, and into space, none of our known approaches at NASA could get us anywhere. And what is really shocking about the interview we just did from the top defense contractor in America is they now know how to go to the stars and beyond. We actually know that. And it's actually not just theory. The work is being done so that a certain amount of humans will be able to make the exodus or the movement to another star system. But what is really shocking is that the powers behind the Kennedy assassination, according to Madeleine Brown's testimony, are the same powers we're fighting with global warming. And essentially, they are the giant conglomerate oil companies. They would rather see the whole planet die and their children die and have their money than to see us all survive and then take a massive reduction in profits. And that is just so shocking to me. I can't believe it. But what I'm doing in this film is I'm interviewing, you know, top scientists. We're looking at, you know, anti-gravity, breakthroughs in propulsion physics, explain to people and teaching them what is the problem in physics and our inability and our current understanding of science to move from one star system to another and how we can ultimately get there. I mean, here we are on a planet, and all planets only have a certain amount of time before they give up their energy, they reach an annihilation period, and that civilization has to reach space. We actually only have so much time. We're speeding up the timeline by millions of times with global warming and sewage pollution and all the things we're doing to the planet. We're kicking ourselves out of paradise is what we're doing. And when you see how many UFO sightings are going on in the last couple of years, the recent sighting in Chicago O'Hare that was witnessed by, you know, over a dozen United Airlines pilots and 50 civilians, I mean, they're really here. And when you look at inside interviews like we have with, you know, defense contractors, they've been studying UFOs, and they candidly admit this on tape, since, you know, pre-Roswell. And they've been trying to reverse engineer their craft for the very reason of the advancement of aviation and aeronautics. And top scientists at NASA don't know about this. They don't know about it because the people at NASA don't, you know, build the space shuttle's engines. They don't build the propulsion systems. That's all done by the big, you know, contractors. And those scientists there are the ones that are on the cutting edge. And that's, you know, one of the most profound people I have interviews in my film. I mean, we're interviewing ufologists, sky watchers, historians, physicists, even we got a really incredible interview with Robert Thurman, who translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Time magazine called him one of the 25 most influential people in the world in 1997, and he's pretty much the Dalai Lama's top, you know, translator. And we asked him about the Buddhist perspective on UFOs. And then we go into the spiritual and ethical question. There are 6.5 billion souls on this planet right now, souls, real living beings. And what do the different religions of the world teach us will happen to an exodus from a planet of 6.5 billion souls? And that's one of the things we're doing in the film also, is we're looking at the different perspectives. And then you want to find out what really happens scientifically at the moment of death. I mean, are our religions consistent with what people are really experiencing, or are they in alignment with the real truth? One of the things I loved about the scientist we just interviewed is he said his motto is he doesn't look at theory as the highest, archetype. He looks at data. He looks at data first, and if data disagrees with Einstein's theory, it doesn't matter. When you're looking for the truth, you have to look at real data to find out what actually happens. How do you actually, you know, defy the laws of gravity? How do you actually move to another star system? Because the current laws of physics under Einstein and Newton keep us bound on this planet. Nothing can move faster than the speed of light. So what we're doing in this film in the end is finding out how do we get to a not only another star system. Our closest star systems are Alpha Centauri A and B, which are 4.2 and 4.3 light years from Earth, which means even if you could reach the speed of light, it would take you 4.5 years to get there. And then you look at Sirius, which is 8.7 light years away, and then you look at the Pleiades, which are the group of the seven, you know, blue shining stars, are over 40 light years away. And then you look at Andromeda, this whole other galaxy, our closest neighboring galaxy, is 2.2 million light years away. So if you traveled at the speed of light, it would take you over 2 million years to get there, and that's not fast enough. It's nowhere near fast enough. So how, what is the code? What is the code that prevents us from moving faster than the speed of light? What is there a code on matter itself, and how do we break the code? And that has been, ever since I saw a UFO at 7 years old in Berkeley, California, in 1967, 68, that has been my life's mission, is to find out how do we become free of the fabric of space-time, and how do we move? How are these UFOs doing it, and how ultimately can we do it so that we're no longer bound by this planet? And that's kind of where everything goes in this film.
Wow, that's awesome. I know when people ask me a question like, do you think that UFOs come from other star systems, mm-hmm. I have to say, well, two parts of me. One, the physicist says, no, I don't think people can jump in a tin can and ride for 40 or 2.2 million light years to get here. Mm-hmm. It's just not feasible.
No.
You'd go through generations of people by the time you got here, no matter what their lifespan is.
Mm-hmm.
And the second part of me says there must be a way to open up space-time and jump between layers,
mm-hmm.
or you just can't get here. And when you start looking at the witness testimony, many of these UFOs do not zip across space and go streaking out into space. They just
no.
out.
They go invisible.
Yeah. So there's some dimension that they're slipping into that allows them to truncate this distance. And I guess mm-hmm. my question is, in your opinion, you've had your ear much closer to the ground on this for a lot longer than I have. Do you think that we have in our hands dead or operating craft that are capable of doing that? And do you think we're working on reverse engineering that? Or, even a bigger question, do you think we're actually working with off-world races to perfect that kind of technology?
I think now I have, you know, with this interview we just did in Texas, we actually have the proof of a lot of what you just said, that yes, they have been reverse engineering. I mean, when you really think about it, the crash at Roswell, where would they take it? They wouldn't take it to, you know, the Pentagon, because those guys don't know what to do with it. They would take it to the scientists who work at the top defense contractors to try to reverse engineer it. And in 1945 is the advent of the atomic bomb. I mean, we had perfected nuclear weapons in 1945. We dropped them on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in July of 1945. And then by 1947, the Roswell incident, we had two more years to evolve, you know, our nuclear sciences at Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico and all over the country. So you really look at the level of science at that moment. There's no question that where the craft would have gone would have been the defense contractors. And I now have proof that that actually occurred and where it actually happened. And that's going to be in From Here to Andromeda. And it's not... You know, this is not one of those witnesses that doesn't have any credibility. This is a witness who has, you know, has 26 U.S. patents that are registered and numbered, which you can look up on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. He has a real name. He's not like, you know, Bob Lazar, where you can't find his name in the employee register. And even so, Bob Lazar, I believe, is a very authentic and truth-telling person. But the credibility of this individual is so high. When you even consider Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell, he's a colonel in the Air Force. He's not a scientist. So a colonel can tell you only so much because he doesn't understand what he's looking at. If you put an Air Force colonel in front of a flying saucer that's in pieces, he wouldn't know how to tell you anything about how it really works. He would only be able to read the reports that go across his desk. He would read the abstract or the long and short of it. But these scientists have actually disclosed to me, you know, on camera, the real truth, and I think the reason they have is because they know we're not going to survive, that this truth needs to get out. We only have so much time as a civilization to figure out either how to save the planet or get off of it. And unfortunately, in the case of Gary McKinnon, the British UFO hacker who hacks into the military, back into their computer hard drives, he found what he believes is proof that they're sitting on technology that could solve the energy crisis. They could solve the global warming and the greenhouse gas problem because it's an energy technology that is beyond nuclear. And those exact words were used by my scientist. This is an energy source that is beyond solar and wind technology, which is sustainable, and beyond atomic energy. It's not atomic energy. In fact, he has now identified, and he has personally done, he's doing the work on this. There are four major nuclear forces known. There is a fifth that is debatable. And, these forces that we've already identified bind us into the laws of relativity, Einstein's relativity. You have your strong force that binds the nuclear atomic, pairs together. You have gravity, you have electromagnetism, and you have your nuclear forces all kind of identified. Now, what they're saying now is that they have actually identified force number 5, 6, 7, and 8, which don't even have names yet. And they didn't just identify them. They know where they are. They know where they are. And those forces are so many times faster than the speed of light that you cannot identify them with light itself. Our scientist actually describes that, imagine a person who's blind, who can't see light, but a blind person can hear. And a blind person will say that the fastest velocity there is, because they're blind, is the speed of sound, because they can only hear sound waves. And sound waves travel at about roughly 750 miles an hour at sea level, which is very slow. And a light wave travels at 670 million miles per hour, or 186,282 miles per second. And that's fast in a local environment, but it's not fast when you're looking at other star systems and other galaxies. I mean, you're talking about Andromeda, 2.2 million light years from here. We're not even seeing Andromeda in real time. We're seeing it as it was 2.2 million years ago in our telescope. So we're almost in this alternate time warp universe ourselves. So when you look at what causes that limitation, it is the four or five known nuclear forces right now, which is strong, gluons, what binds atoms together, electromagnetism, which is radio waves, and light photons, and then you have your weak force, which is W and Z bosons, and then you have gravity or gravitons. So those forces bind us in the matrix on the fabric of space-time. What this scientist is saying is they have now identified these higher forces, and he actually taught me where they are right in front of me. And I ended up finding out that my physics that I've been working on myself for over a decade on UFO technology is dead on the money. I mean, I'm right down, going down the garden path.
Yeah. Well, I know the only thing that really worries me is that the key word is that it's military scientists. And usually the funding that is generated to do this kind of research, because really there's no payback. It's not something you're going to mass produce for sale. This is a black hole of intergovernmental tax money. The idea that the military has a hold of it, and that first it's going to go through the, gee, can we make a better weapon out of this filter, that's the thing that really worries me. And I look back at if legend tells us anything about the Atlanteans and the Lemurians and the ability of them to create these global world-destroying weapons, and that one day they just decided to go to war, and they end up not destroying each other, but changing the face of the world. Do we have the capability of walking up to this precipice, this self-destructive point of no return, and walking away from it?
Well, that's a great question. And, when you look at most of the great physicists of the past, 4 or 5 decades, unfortunately, even Einstein, as great as he is, he actually wrote the letter to President Roosevelt urging the fission of uranium to build a bomb that could end the war. And him and Leo Szilard, one of his students, actually wrote the letter. Szilard, you know, and Einstein did it together. And, you know, here's these, you know, brilliant, and a lot of them are, you know, Jewish scientists. I mean, frankly, you know, the Jews were some of the most brilliant physicists. People like, you know, Murray Gell-Mann. Today you have people like Richard Feynman. And then, you know, of course, you have, you know, some physicists that are non-Jews. But somehow they're some of the most brilliant ones. But they're all working on weapons or theoretical physics. And their theoretical physics leads to weapons. And what the scientist I'm talking about is, he is a non-public person, but a well-documented person. I mean, he's someone that has a real
right.
paper trail. These right. guys make the known celebrities, like, you know, the known celebrities. When I say celebrities, you have people like Stephen Hawking is a celebrity physicist. Carl Sagan was a celebrity physicist. Those guys are nothing compared to where these researchers are at. And the reason they're nothing is they don't have access to the UFO crash retrievals. They don't have access to this technology that's beyond, you know, our understandings. And the ones that do have the access know how to go beyond the four or five known forces. And also, think about the human body. We have five known senses. We have touch, smell, sight, hearing, and, you know, we have our main, you know, five senses. And beyond, the sixth sense is called the invisible or spiritual sense. And then, of course, you can philosophize about a seventh, eighth, and ninth sense. And physicists are now identifying something beyond the four or five known forces. So we're kind of, the human body is very similar to the actual forces themselves. And when you're talking about stuff like this, it is so over the heads of the theoretical physicists themselves because they don't have access to the data. Data is the key word here. They don't have access to the proper data to take themselves beyond. And they get all the publicity. They kind of keep the world, you know, thinking inside of this box called, you know, space-time and the speed of light limit. Well, why does all, to answer your question, why does all do all the weapon scientists have the data, have access to it? Because the reason is, and the reason crash retrievals are, you know, laughed at by the media and because people don't have access to the data. They don't know that they really have these things. And the reason is we are afraid. We are a civilization of fear. We're afraid of our neighbor down the street. We're afraid of the other country, of the other culture. We can't even get along religiously. So when you think about the fact that the major religions in the Middle East can't even get along, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, think about what it means for another star civilization to come to us who has a whole new set of beliefs and understandings, and obviously if you can go from another star system to Earth, your physics is way beyond our understanding, then that means it threatens us, so we are afraid of it. So what really happened at Roswell, the real truth about Roswell, which will be in my film, and an actual testimony from the scientists, well, it will shock the world. It will shock the world. It's not what everybody thinks at all. It's worse than that.
It may shock the world on many levels, not just propulsion and the fact that...
just propulsion. I'm saying that we shot them down, and we didn't use bullets. I go through this in my film. I have what's called the UFO briefing scene. I bring eight of the top ufologists in the field, and we debate the question about crash retrievals. Why are so many UFOs crashing all over the planet? I mean, you can go from one star system to Earth, and you get here and you crash. It's kind of like I have a date with a beautiful girl, and I finally get to her house. I knock on the door, and I trip and fall and hit my head, and I die when I get there. You know, I know how to drive through traffic and all this stuff, but I can't go up the steps. I'm not buying it. I'm not buying the fact that ETs are all crashing when they get here. And what I propose is that there is possibly a war going over between extraterrestrials, just like little kids. They find this beautiful planet, it's gorgeous, blue oceans, you know, tuna fish and dolphins in the sea and beautiful fruits and vegetables. And they go, God, these people are going to destroy this place. Let's just sit around and camp out until they're all gone and we'll take it next. And one guy dubs it. He dubs it, it's my planet. And then another civilization comes along and sees and says, no, we want this planet. and they start fighting each other over who gets Earth next. And that's what I think is going on, and I actually ask every one of these ufologists to their opinion from the data they have actually, you know, studied, is that actually occurring? And then you ask the question is, if somebody finally does get here, which is what we all want to know, we're not alone in the universe, imagine your visitor finally comes to say, hey, I'm friendly, we're not alone in the universe, and we shoot them down because we're so afraid. We're afraid of the people in the Middle East and Israel. So someone from another star system, we're going to be terrified of it. But what do we shoot them down with is the real question. And I asked this scientist, I said, you know, there's no way you could shoot them down with a bullet, because a bullet in World War II is traveling at, you know, 1,500 miles an hour, and that's not fast enough. And he just looked at me, and he didn't say anything, and he said, we have weapons that you can't even imagine. And of course, you know, I understood what he was talking about. You're talking about, you know, electromagnetic pulse weapons and you know, radioactive weapons that can dismantle the electronics of some of these crafts. So when he looked at me and he said that, and he said that, you know, we shot, he actually knows the actual person, the Air Force pilot who shot down the craft at Roswell, and he's alive today. He's a medical doctor. He was a young guy in 1947. And he's saying this on camera. So when you name names and you have credentials and you make a statement like that, the statement has a lot of weight to it. So if we're shooting them down, why aren't they shooting us down is the next question. Why aren't they at war with us?
Yeah, well,
and that's where the
question starts. Do they travel all this way with weaponry on them, or are they really just explorers? And
are they really just explorers? And look at us on Mars and Cassini, you know, going out to Jupiter and Saturn. We're not arming Cassini with weapons. It's an explorer craft.
Right.
And so why would they? Because weapons are heavy. You've got to haul them around. You've got to have a bigger ship to have all these weapons with you. Why would they take them? They're like, hey, these guys are going to be so happy to see us. We're going to tell them they're not alone in the universe. It's going to be a great party. You know, two star systems are going to get together and have a good time. And they get here and we shoot them down because that's how afraid we are. But it's also possible that the reason the order was given to shoot down the craft at Roswell, and this is a much more scary question, is you're talking about World War II ends in you know, with dropping the atomic bomb in 1945 in the summer of 1945 on Japan. That was it. Everyone was afraid of us because we had the atomic bomb. So in 1947, just 2 years later, there was a lot of fear and evidence that Hitler was reverse engineering UFO technology. And if he had built a fleet of flying saucers that are anti-gravitic, they could outperform all of our best fighters, and oh my God, he could conquer the world. And even though Hitler was already dead, his legacy was had not been destroyed yet. And so we might have thought, and this is a possible scenario, we didn't think the craft at Roswell was from another planet. We might have thought it was, you know, the Russians or the Germans or whoever, and it's in U.S. airspace. And anything in U.S. airspace after a war is a target. And I think that's probably the reason they gave the order to shoot it down. They didn't know there was going to be aliens inside of this thing.
You might want to interview my co-author. When she was a little girl, they were in a car headed across the desert, and she believes she was in the desert the night of the Roswell crash.
Mm-hmm.
And she believes she witnessed the Roswell crash, and there was a large flash overhead. Mm-hmm. One craft landed in Roswell, and one craft landed, I don't know, 180 miles away and made a big flash on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in those days, there were no street lights. You had old cars, and you ran at 40 mm-hmm. miles an hour. You traveled at night across the desert because it was too hot. And there were only mm-hmm. two vehicles, five people between the vehicles, and they pulled over when it happened. But they didn't realize what it was. They thought maybe it was lightning or a meteorite or something like that. And she didn't realize until about 10 or 15 years ago, because they lived in a rural area of Tennessee, didn't have cable, never heard about the Roswell crash. And she mm-hmm. finally became exposed to it. And I interviewed her about 3 months ago about it, and she's getting on up in years. You might look her up and interview her, see if that's credible.
Well, yeah, I'd be very interested, because according to what I believe the weapon we dropped, the orders was given, was an EMP, or electromagnetic pulse weapon, which would fry all of the electronics in the craft itself. And once you fry the electronics, the thing can't fly.
Sure.
And, you know, that's probably what they used, and that would produce an enormous flash, especially if it was gammas, intense gamma radiation, and, you know, ultraviolet invisible light would consequent from an EMP weapon. And, yeah, that would
wouldn't hurt an airplane that runs on a diesel engine and flies with cable. It probably wouldn't hurt it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the current theory, according to Stanton Friedman, is a lightning strike struck down the craft at Roswell. And I researched that and just tear it apart. I mean, NASA has lots of data and photographs of commercial and military airliners and aircraft getting struck by lightning. Even videotape I've seen from the inside of a cockpit of a lightning strike. And it can burn the surface material of the metal, but it's not going to take down a flying saucer.
No, the skin effect, it would just go right around it. And according to my co-author, the stars were out. There was not a cloud in the sky when they were driving across the desert. There was no storm that night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the storm theory, I mean, it happened within the week, and nobody has the exact date of Roswell. Roswell, the date is similar to the date of the first atomic bomb test at Trinity, which also is hard to get the exact date. I've heard July 5th, 7th, 9th, 15th, 13th of 1945. And then it's the same on Roswell, July, 7th, 8th, 9th, and on throughout that week. 1947 is roughly the date of the crash. So when people are trying to line this storm that came through with the exact date of the crash, they can't get it dead on. And if this woman is saying there was no storm and there were stars and there was a flash, well, that would have been the EMP weapon dropped by this particular pilot who was still alive.
That's amazing.
We took it down. But remember, they have a right. I mean, World War II just ended. It could have been the Germans. We didn't know. I mean, one of the problems with a lot of the contacts with extraterrestrials is they don't send a broadcast on our inferior radio technology and announce their arrival. They just kind of come in a very intrusive way, and they don't identify themselves as, hey, we're, you know, in some way, you know, I don't know how they would do it in a way that's non-threatening. And to come in right after World War II, if they knew anything about our history by studying our, you know, radio broadcasts, then they would know that's not a very good idea. Jaime Muisson says that one of the reasons there's so many sightings in Mexico is because they don't shoot them down in Mexico. And that makes a lot of sense, that, you know, we're much more aggressive.
Oh, I understand. Well, that beep means we have a caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from? What's your first name? Do we have a caller on the line? No, I heard the beep, but I guess we don't have a caller on the line. We must
stay with me here for a second.
All right, hang on. That's my producer, Don.
How are you doing?
We're doing wonderful.
Again, you always amaze me. Dr. Agnew?
Yes.
I can honestly say to every one of your listeners, yours is the finest show. That one of the finest shows in its field, finest shows on the air, period. I absolutely love this interview. But I do have a question.
All right.
And because I've thought about what you're talking about long and hard. Let's say you're an ET and you're coming to Earth and you understand the rules of karma. Let's say you do. And the best way for you to get your information and agreements and start working with a civilization might be to get knocked down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then allow the government to proceed as you know they're going to. Does that make any sense to you?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's kind of like a sacrificial lamb.
It is.
Sending in.
But you already know who's going to be sacrificed. Those people might already know that it might be a time for them to cross over or whatever. It's a plan set up. It comes down here. They then integrate with the government, give the various technologies. And it's one way for, you know, maybe a manipulative group or force out there to integrate. What do you think? It's just a thought.
Well, it's a good when the question that can't be answered is, if we shot them down and they were upset about it, why didn't they attack us? Well, there are some cases, and one of them is very recent, which is also going to be in my film. which involves the space shuttle Columbia incident, not the Challenger, the Columbia, where it came apart over it was all over the southern United States, and the astronauts lost their lives. And this case is really, really terrifying. It involves an amateur astronomer who is a British person whose name was kept out of the story. In the San Francisco Chronicle, they said this man had taken 5 photographs that show a purple corkscrewing wave striking the space shuttle. And Tammy Jernigan, space shuttle astronaut, takes the guy's camera, and they take it back to Houston, to NASA headquarters, and they examine the photographs, and all they say, without publishing the photographs online, no one was allowed to see the photographs. And I now have all 5 photographs because someone heard me on the Art Bell Show and heard me talking about this and sent them to me. And it is so shocking what is in these photographs. I will tell you that I don't understand why we are so unwilling to look at the real data on this case. And I'll tell you what actually happens in this case. And it's really a terrifying thing to talk about, because you're talking about the lives of Americans that may, and I'm not saying I know this for certain, may have been targeted by an extraterrestrial civilization, by a very advanced weapon. And the particular weapon that was used, I'm trying to actually, study it and find out what they were actually using, but I'm not exactly sure what the weapon used was. But what it shows in the 5 photographs is it shows what NASA is calling, and this is just pure BS to anyone who knows anything about physics, a super lightning strike that is coming from above the space shuttle. And the space shuttle is coming in, at least Mach 13. I don't have my notes in front of me. The space shuttle does 18,000 miles an hour as it's traveling around the Earth itself. And when it comes in, it just goes a little bit slower than that. It's burning up. I mean, it's going faster than anything can travel down here. And what starts to happen is you understand that the altitude of the space shuttle is higher than any lightning strike has ever been recorded on the planet.
Well, sure. It's up around 140,000 feet, and the highest thunderhead we can imagine is only 55,000 feet.
Right.
And even if there's a blue jet out of the top of that, it's only going to go up maybe another 5,000 or 6,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
You're 80,000 feet above any kind of cloud formations.
Right. So basically what happens is, in the photographs, we are being told by NASA, and without getting to examine them, the actual owner of the photographs is Dr. Peter Goldie in London, and he doesn't believe the American public has the right to see his photographs. When one of the 5 was published online, he demanded in copyright law they remove it. He kept his name out of the story, but when he asked the person to remove it, the person who was asked to remove it, one of them, sent them to me. And under the Fair Use Act, I'm allowed to use the photos for educational purposes only. I'm going to have to do simulations of his photos in my film, but I'm going to do very accurate simulations. And photo 1 shows this streaking purple violet colored corkscrewing wave kind of spiraling down from higher than the space shuttle. And as what you see is the guy's camera, Peter Goldie's camera, is in San Francisco. It's before sunrise, so you have to use a tripod with a very long exposure. He's taking 4 to 5 second exposures. So the first photograph shows this thing coming down. You see the point. It looked like it was targeting itself straight at the space shuttle, imagining it could shoot it instantaneously. When it crosses the path of where the space shuttle was in a direct straight-ahead target, the space shuttle is now further ahead. And this thing, as it passes that point, course corrects, turns left at 90 degrees, which is impossible for any missile to do at those velocities. You're talking about, Mach 13 or 14, which is, 13 times the speed of sound. You're talking about, many thousands of miles an hour. And then this thing, he depresses the shutter and takes another photograph. And the next photograph, it's accelerating, going faster than the shuttle and gaining on it. You can see it getting very close to the head of the shuttle. And then in the third photograph, it strikes the shuttle. It does. There's no fraying. There's no other tentacles on this particular thing coming in that they're saying is a lightning strike. And once it strikes the shuttle, in the next frame, the shuttle's path gets much brighter, which means it transferred its energy, which I believe is some kind of kinetic energy transfer, to the shuttle. And then all of a sudden, moments later, the shuttle is breaking apart and it's gone. We lose them.
All right. That beat means we have another caller on the line. Caller, can you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Yeah, this is Bob from Arkansas. And let me take the opportunity to say that you are the very first alternative radio program that I listened to, I guess, just about a year ago. And, you know, I really love your shows. I really do.
Wow, I'm so flattered, Bob. Thank you so much.
And, you know, I catch you on the Kevin Smith show, and I kind of follow you around a little bit. But anyway, you guys, I'm just a simple guy. And I've gone through some not-so-simple things here this past year. And, you know, I don't even have a high school education. But I've spent this past year especially reading as much information and listening to the programs, and it's opened something up. And what I'm having a problem with is what I'm trying to discover is, I know this sounds funny, but about 7 weeks ago, we had carnations in my house that at about 10:30 at night, that was just so thick and it smelled so well. But I can't uncover much information about this. And I'll say before that is I saw a UFO. I don't know if it was ours or theirs or whose, but I definitely saw something. It was a cigar shaped with three big black appendages on it, kind of like a movie screen, I guess. But it was sometime after that that there was a large globe or orb, I guess they call them, out in front of my house about 1:30 in the afternoon. My dog was barking. I went outside to see what she was barking at, and it just blew me away. There was this bright, it kind of looked like, it was whitish blue, but it was encased of like a metal glass kind of, that's how it appeared. And then it changed to like a, almost like you could see through it, but you couldn't. And then it drifted off about 15 feet and just disappeared. And then it was a few weeks after that that we had the carnation incident here in the house. And so my question is, and I know I'm digressing a little bit off of what the program is, but I think it may be related, is do you guys have any knowledge of what the carnations in my house was? It was about 30 minutes.
Were the carnations in your house? Did you see them?
No. It was the smell of carnations, and very thick and very, very nice.
I've heard of cases like that in apparitions of saints. I mean, you know, even appearances of the Virgin Mary, which have occurred in the past couple of decades many times. There's the scent of flowers or roses or different, you know, kind of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be a sign that whoever this UFO craft was, that they are somehow not necessarily a saint, but possibly a very peaceful or, you know, non-threatening. I mean, maybe that's their way of making you feel comfortable also, you know, because you have a familiar smell that
right.
just appears, you know, in your house. That's pretty amazing.
It really was, and my girlfriend has been kind of concerned about, you know, I mentioned the orb outside of the house. While I was on the computer one night studying, there was about a half dozen little pinpoint whitish blue lights that did an incredible dance just 2 feet away from me while I was on the computer, you know, doing my studies, and it stayed there for, I mean, you know, so long that you couldn't deny what you were seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had them again come through the front wall of the house while me, the dog, and the girlfriend were watching TV. And me and the dog jumped up and were going crazy, but Cindy couldn't see them. And
mm-hmm.
But in this last instance with the carnations, it had a very settling effect for her.
Mm-hmm.
And me too. I mean, I know there's still a lot of concern.
You know, I mean, you have to be careful. I mean, they're, it's easy for an extraterrestrial. I mean, to put a smell that makes you feel at home and relaxed is good,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't necessarily mean they're non-threatening. I mean,
right.
like I said before, I mean, when these craft come in, they need to identify themselves as non-threatening so that we feel comfortable, and a smell may have been an attempt on their part to make you feel comfortable. I don't think there's any evidence of them, you know, obviously they've never used a nuclear weapon against any human civilization. They've never shot a missile at us or you know, any kind of really advanced weapon. There's only, in abductions, there's only a couple of cases or one case where a person was actually murdered. I don't think when they abduct people, I don't think they're doing anything different than we do to frogs and frogs ponds. You know, I made that point clear in my film, Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs, last year.
Right.
And they're just doing scientific experimentation on us. And we would do the same thing. If we went to another planet and we saw a vulnerable life form that we could easily manipulate and take out of its environment, we would do some little tests on it and put it back in.
Right.
Put it back in the frog's pond. And that's what they do to us. They do some tests, they look at you, and then they put you back. You know, they don't actually come and slaughter you and hang you on a hook. And there's no, I believe there's only one case I've ever heard of at a UFO conference where someone was actually murdered.
Right,
you know, flat
you
out
know,
murdered.
I don't really have any recollection of anything like that. But, you guys, I have to share this with you right now. As we're talking on the phone, I've got hundreds of blackbirds coming all around the house feeding. I mean, just...
Really?
Yes, I mean, it's incredible. hundreds of them are just all over my house right now.
Oh, my God.
be sure to call us back if that carnation smell comes up in the next 2 hours, because we're going to be on the air.
You know, you guys,
hours.
I will.
And we'd like to have a live report. I appreciate the phone call, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Agnew and Mr. Payne. And I'm going to go back to the radio and listen to you guys.
All right,
so,
thanks so much.
So, Brooks, let's go back, because I have my file in front of me on the space shuttle here. And
yeah,
I had a
caller just write me and ask me, are you sure that this weapon beam came from an ET, or do you think it came from...
Well, I'll tell you why I deduct that.
Right.
that, because, you know, I go through a process of elimination on all of our munitions and weapons and missiles. Now, the space shuttle is at 207,000 feet. That's where communication was lost. And it's doing Mach 18, about 12,500 miles an hour. So it's going Mach 18. And then this thing comes in from above, and it spirals and corkscrews. And at first I thought, oh, maybe that's a Sidewinder missile, and which is ironic because the scientist I interviewed in Dallas actually designed the Sidewinder missile. He's the head of the whole team who built it at General Dynamics in the 1970s or 80s. And then you see this thing do a course correction at 90 degrees, and you know the space shuttle is going 18,000 miles an hour. 12,500 miles an hour. So you look at what actual munition do we have that can travel faster than 12,500 miles an hour, and that's when you start getting, the thing starts to get more interesting. And you also have to look at NASA's theory that this is a lightning strike. Now, that's another interesting thing, because I've got lots of video of lightning strikes that I've shot on video cameras. My video camera I was using with lightning is a Canon XL1, and it shoots at 30 frames per second, which is a great way to disprove the lightning theory. A single lightning strike, the longest lightning strikes I have in New Mexico, are at about a tenth of a second, which takes up about... out of 30 frames, you just take 3 frames, and then you have a lightning strike over 3 frames. Most lightning strikes only appear in 1 frame or 1/30th of a second, and some of them will take up, 10 frames, which is a third of a second. That's the longest one I found. Now, Peter Goldie, according to the data, he is exposing his camera, which is a, actually I have the make and model number. It's a digital camera. It is 4 to 6 seconds exposures, and that's according to the San Francisco Chronicle, what they actually said about the actual camera he's actually using. You know, it's actually not a very... It's a Nikon 800 digital camera, which is an older camera, and it's on a tripod. So the wiggle of the actual incoming weapon is not caused by hand-holding the camera. Had he been hand-holding the camera in the wiggle, the space shuttle line would have produced a wiggle too, and it doesn't. So it's very clear it's on a tripod. Now the problem is, I could believe a lightning strike would show up in 1 frame in 4 seconds, because even at a third of a second, the longest lightning strike, it would expose the film. But then he takes another photo, And there's a time lapse between the moment he depresses the shutter on the second photo and the time he took his last photo. And the thing is still there from beginning to end. It left a trail. So the whole thing is still there, and it's progressing and advancing on the shuttle, which means this is no lightning strike. And then it shows up again on the third exposure of 4 to 6 seconds, and the fourth and the fifth. So there's no way a lightning strike can last over 30 seconds.
Yeah, 30 seconds long, you know, propagating in the same path, that's impossible.
Yeah, it's impossible. So you can testify to that being a physicist. So the question is, what is moving faster than the 12,500 miles an hour in the space shuttle and gaining on it? And then when it strikes it, what weapons do we actually have that would match that? So I researched all of the different types of munitions we actually have in weapons. And when you look at the velocity of, you know, Tomahawk land attack missiles to about 550 miles an hour, sorry, you're nowhere near 12,500 miles an hour. You look at the AGM-88 high-speed anti-radiation missile, has an air-to-surface tactical missile designed to seek out and destroy enemy radar equipment. That's 760 miles an hour. That doesn't match it. The Stinger missile, it does about pretty fast missile, but still it goes only Mach 2.2, which is 1,500 miles an hour. And the Sidewinder, which was designed by the scientist I interviewed, it does about Mach 2.5, which is still, you know, only about 1,500 miles an hour. So, and then you look at an Evolved Sea Sparrow missile we have, does about 2,800 miles an hour in a range of 27 miles. You have to look at range on missiles, too, because the space shuttle is going 12,500 miles an hour. So none of our smaller missiles can go anywhere near the speed we're talking about. We have an AIM-120 medium-range-to-air missile, does a Mach 4. But you're still nowhere near Mach, you know, the Mach 18 is what we're talking about here. So
no, and you got to consider that the space shuttle was about 25 miles up, too.
Yeah,
so
it's
even,
way up there. So
missile, yeah,
and this thing comes from above, not below. It's very clear in Peter Goldie's photographs that it's coming from above. So the question is, what missiles can travel at Mach, you know, at 15,000 miles an hour, which you would need to go faster? And the only ones that can do it are the Minuteman ICBM missile, which is a nuclear warhead, you know, costing approximately $30 million each, and it will do 18,000 miles an hour. And then you also look at, you know, some of the Trident missile also. So you're looking at the Minuteman and the Trident are the only missiles that could do that. But that when you're going 18,000 miles an hour, can you turn right and course correct? Can a missile handle those kind of G-forces? And the question would be probably not. Most likely, probably not. And would we fire a nuclear missile at our own space shuttle? No way. So when you start to look at the improbability that any of our weapons would be used against the space shuttle, and that there's no way, you know, this is coming from above, not below. It's not coming from the ground up. That this is no lightning strike, because we did process elimination on that. So the question is, what is it? And obviously, it doesn't match any of the known weapons that we have. And it's definitely not a laser, because pulse lasers and microwave radiation lasers travel at the speed of light and would strike the shuttle almost instantaneously.
Sure,
this thing
exactly.
It's not behaving like a laser. So what is it? Is it part of Star Wars? Was it a Star Wars, you know, laser test that went wrong? Was it an electromagnetic pulse weapon? Was it a kinetic weapon? It behaves more like a kinetic weapon. Kinetic weapons transfer a shock wave of kinetic energy into their target, and the shock wave essentially shatters it, just like an opera singer's voice can shatter a glass. But the question is, none of our kinetic weapons, because they're actual munitions, could handle the G-forces on the turn at 18,000 miles an hour.
Exactly.
So
We'll follow up on that question in about 6 minutes. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio, and we'll be back after these messages. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your never-ending life
is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind. Find your soulmate. And know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours. And your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPack has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPack is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
Expanding consciously.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. Listen, I appreciate the communications. We've had phone calls. We're getting lots of IMs coming in. If you want to reach us, you can go to AOL Instant Messenger. My username is Vision Officer. You can easily find that. Or you can just go to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. And my username is there on the front. We use AOL. It works really well for us, and that way you can flash us messages if you're too shy to come on the radio. Before we start this hour, I want to bring you some news concerning the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We have come to the deadline for submitting our contract and our deposit. Unless we have some sort of windfall this week, it looks like we will be postponing the expedition until the summer of 2008. We just learned that the Russian government has placed restrictions on the scientific equipment we can bring on the ship. They are requiring us to register the equipment with them 12 months in advance of any expedition using their ships. This means that we cannot take sonar, gas chromatographs, or spectrometers of any kind unless they are first registered. And due to the Patriot Act, we cannot board any equipment from any source other than the point of departure. I can't get around this. So we're going to postpone the expedition until June or July of 2008. Not to worry, though. I will be going to Tibet in 10 days for a couple of weeks to film the first leg of the documentary. I will bring that back in April and begin producing the first part of the documentary. You'll be able to purchase it from the website and the usual outlets like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. Also, don't forget to sign up for the 14 Magic Days in Egypt. You're going to hear a commercial on that in our next break. But go to X Squared Radio, click on the banner. This trip includes all the airfare, meals, and excellent access to the pyramids, Abydos, and other very rare sites. You have a few months yet to prepare. I want you to come with us. So click on the 14 Magic Days banner with Maureen St. Germain at X Squared Radio for more details. My very excellent guest is David Sereda. His website is fromheretoandromeda.com. He's going to be updating that, I'm sure, daily. There is a trailer. There's some updates. You can find out who's in the credits of the film. This is going to be an earth-shaking production when it comes out. We're going to do everything we can to help David get this out in the theaters as well. Just keep up with that website, bookmark it, go to it as often as you can, and keep up with David Sereda and his work on From Here to Andromeda. I want to talk this hour a little bit more about that film, but I also want to talk about your lecture that you did on the singularity. But before we get to that, we were right in the middle of an awesome discussion about what many think was just a horrible space accident of the space shuttle falling apart in the upper atmosphere, and the appearance of a series of photographs that have captured on them nearly impossible, well, I would say impossible to be lightning, impossible to be a laser beam. It has to be some kind of, like David says, some kind of kinetic weapon traveling just faster than the shuttle and catching up with it from above. So we were in the middle of that discussion. Let's pick up where we were on that, can we, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, this is very clear. Now, we can't identify that it's extraterrestrial, but when we go through the process of elimination of the data that we have, I mean, other than known weapons that I can research, there's no known weapon other than a kinetic weapon that behaves like this. Because it doesn't, when it strikes the shuttle, the shuttle doesn't explode. It starts to break apart, and then it falls apart. But then you have to look at, there's another possibility here, which is I haven't even looked at yet, and that is that once something happened to me, you know, as I announced this on the radio, a woman from San Francisco who wants to remain anonymous, and this is a fact, she did not see my PDF presentation with the five photos from Peter Goldie. Once again, I like to expose his name, Dr. Peter Goldie from London, because he doesn't believe you, the American people, deserve to see the truth of the photographs he took. And neither does NASA. Tammy Jernigan at NASA, shuttle astronaut, publishes the story in the San Francisco Chronicle. And in the end, they tell you, oh, don't worry, it's just a lightning strike. But they don't want you to see all five of his photographs. Now, this woman writes me without seeing my presentation. And she basically says that she had this dream the night of the shuttle incident. And she lives in San Francisco, where the photographer actually is. And in the dream, she sees this bright golden flash of light that is so bright that you can't look at it spiritually in her dream. And she said in the dream it took all the astronauts with it in the beam of light, did not harm them, but pursuing, the shuttle is destroyed. Now, when I sent her my PDF presentation, which I just sent you, Brooks, so you can actually look at these photos yourself, and you can verify that what I'm saying is true in them. In her experience, I thought it was really amazing because she had no knowledge of these photographs in the Chronicle. She didn't even know about the article. But what is possible here? This is a reverse, a complete 180-degree turn. That rather than the shuttle being destroyed by this incoming, it was coming to take the astronauts themselves. It was some kind of a wormhole that was going to dematerialize their bodies and take them somewhere else, because in her dream they get taken aboard a mothership, and which would mean that this thing was positive and it was trying to save them physically. And then according to her dream, they would be returned to Earth at some point and they would all be alive. And that would mean it was a rescue mission that they are, and according to her dream. Now, everything in her dream, the blinding flash of light, if you think of, and, you know, look at the photos, you know, that I just sent you to your email. It's in a PDF presentation format. You'll see, you can imagine when this thing strikes the shuttle on the third photograph, you can see how much brighter the shuttle got. The path of the shuttle, the white streak over the 4 to 5 second exposure gets so much brighter at that exact intersection. Would be very consistent with this woman's dream that this flash of light occurs. But her dream is the opposite of a weapon. You know, immediately it looks like a weapon because we know the shuttle came apart. So this would mean that they knew the shuttle was going to blow apart, that it was already on its way down, but it was a rescue mission. And so what's difficult about this is until I had this woman write me about her dream, I had no way of even having that possible thought that it was a rescue operation and that there is no ET shooting them down.
So do you think it is possible that the crew was exhumed or taken out of the space shuttle and it fell apart naturally in the atmosphere?
Yes, it's possible. It's possible that that's what this strike is. And that really interests me because it shows an incredible benevolent an act of rescue. But the only way to prove it now would be is if this girl's dream, and we're talking about a dream here, that is so consistent with the data in the actual case that if it's correct, I think they will actually be returned to Earth. And if they are, oh my God, that will just be, it'll be like Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind when all these missing pilots from the Bermuda Triangle are returned, you know, generations later, with decades later, without aging. But that would have to actually occur. What's that?
What a story those astronauts would be able to tell.
Oh my God. You know, oh my God, I mean, what a story that would be to be rescued by extraterrestrials. But I think we're getting to that point in our civilization that, like I said, I mean, here we are on the precipice of the eve of our own destruction. I mean, headlines all over the world, I don't know if you've read them, about the bees that are dying and the butterflies also. And Einstein said that in just a couple of years without bees and butterflies, we'd all die. And the reason we would die without bees is they pollinate all of our foods that produce fruits and nuts and vegetables, but for example, squashes and all these things. But even lettuce and spinach, the non-fruit-bearing vegetables, require seeding. And in order for a plant to go to seed, you know, for the next crop, bees have to cross-pollinate the male and female flowers from different plants so that the seeds actually are produced. Now, if you don't have pollination from bees and butterflies, there's no food. We're going to have to do it with duster brushes ourselves. You're going to have to get literally millions of people going around with duster brushes who can identify male and female plants and flowers and cross-pollinate them in order to get food, and that will just be outrageous. And I think we will do a certain amount of that. But what's causing the bees to be dying off by the millions in 24 states, in Italy, in Europe, and all over the world, there are reports. It started in the 1980s. We had this epidemic of bees dying off, and so we developed pesticides to try to attack the pests that were killing the bees. And the pests are these little guys called vampire mites. And the vampire mites thrive in the warmer climate change. As the planet gets warmer, viruses and little mites and even mice start to thrive in the warmer climate because it's not as cold and they don't have as much die-off during the winter months. In fact, this past winter is now globally recorded on CNN as the warmest winter on record. So that means as these things were thriving in the late 80s and they started spraying them, they noticed a 50% die-off of the bee population back then. Vegetable prices soared, but they were able to contain the vampire mites down. Then what happened is the vampire mites developed a resistance to the pesticides. We had to use more pesticides, and then apparently this infection that they gave the bees, called Morgellons disease, was started to transfer as a disease, and the disease started wiping out millions of them. And now they're non-resistant to the pesticides. So this year, I mean, literally, people are seeing hundreds of millions of bees missing in their hives. All the hives are empty. They don't know where the bees' bodies are. They're all gone. And that means that without bees, we all die. And I went on Matt Drudge's website, The Drudge Report, and I couldn't believe some of the comments I read about the bees dying. One woman said, "Oh, every day a boy gets stung. Good riddance to get rid of the bees." You know, without knowing that all of your meals are coming from these little guys. And butterflies, too, because butterflies are prime pollinators as well. And sure. Butterflies date back to 130 million years ago during the early Cretaceous period of the dinosaurs. So these butterflies have survived all of the mass extinctions in history. And without these little creatures, these sensitive little creatures, we are all finished. And that is what's so amazing to me about global warming. People think, oh, you know, the planet, it's only 2 to 3 degrees hotter, so no big deal, you know. I even had a guy call me, found my phone number from somebody, and said, you know, it's going to be more tropical. This old man called me. Everything's going to be better. There's no problem with global warming. Well, excuse me, sir, but what happens to the human body when you raise your body temperature from 98.6 to 100 degrees? You have a fever. If you cannot get your fever down within a month, you will die. And that's what's happening to the planet. It's only a few degrees hotter. It's sick, which means viruses, little mites and things, and viruses and bacteria starts to thrive. It starts to destroy the human body. So the same thing's happening to the planet. Now, without food, you know, we're not going to survive more. I don't know how much seed stock we have stored up right now. For and how many years of seed we have for lettuce and you know tomatoes and all these things, but without seed you don't get future crops. So who's going to do all the pollination? I mean, what are we going to do? Everyone's going to have to move back to the farms and get out of the cities and start dusting flowers all day long. That's where we're headed.
And way to artificially pollinate them. I've got several friends that are beekeepers here in western Kentucky, and we haven't really seen a drop in the bee population here. But
no, it's in 24 states, and California is one of the states. And if you look at where the pollution, the heavy pollution is, and the heavy use of pesticides are, you'll find it's very consistent. So where there's 50 states, it's 24 states, so it's almost half. But there is a die-off. It's 30 to 80% die-off in those 24 states. So in some states, it's 80%. And if this continues, it's going to – it's also reported in Italy, in Rome. I mean, it's all over Europe. It's not just happening in America. It's a global phenomenon. So, yeah, if we lose 30 to 80% of our bees all over the planet, then you're going to see a drop in food production that's equal to that. And that means food is going to be, you know, you can have all these oil companies, this is the irony to me, rather than become do an emergency transformance to sustainability on the planet, so for, you know, using wind and solar technology and electric, you know, cars and getting off of fossil fuels, I mean, in an emergency fashion, rather than do that, we'd rather just sit back and keep raking in their money and kill the planet and kill their own children. That's what they would rather do. Now, there are slow movements by some of the oil companies to adopt wind and solar, but we're not moving fast enough. If the bees are an early indicator to our own survival, then we've got to move in the next 5 years to reduce greenhouse gases by 90%, not what the Kyoto Protocol is doing, talking about reducing it by, you know, a few percent. You've got to reduce it by 90% at least if we're going to survive.
Well, we're going to talk about that a lot more in our third hour. We want to talk about new energy devices and what's being done to bring some of those devices to the consumer level. And we're going to talk about housing and propulsion and electric generation and all kinds of stuff. But the rest
and
of
all
hour,
that is in all that is in From Here to Andromeda, my film. We look at sustainability and we're looking at all of it.
That's awesome.
It's not just about UFOs and how to get off the planet. It's about how do we save our own planet. And if extraterrestrials are interested in their, and they have their eyes on our planet, then that tells you how rare and beautiful this planet is. So we better get it together very quickly. Otherwise, someone else is going to get it next, and we're gone.
Yeah. Well, we've looked far and wide into space, and we have not found anything close to a Class M planet. At least what is not as nice where you can walk out on the beach with no clothing on and virtually, you know, no protection whatsoever. Human skin doesn't protect you against cosmic radiation, I can guarantee you that.
Mm-hmm.
This planet has living systems in place that are just right for the frail human body to live on the surface of its world.
It's just such a beautiful planet. You know, sometimes I wonder what causes people to not be motivated to wanting to have clean air and clean water and no pollution. And I'm come to the conclusion that it has to do with the human state of suffering and misery. I think there are so many people who are suffering and who are miserable. They're not even grateful for the meal on the table. They would assume just die because they're so depressed. And I think that's where the real problem is.
Well, I think so, too. I think largely the population of the world is asleep, and that may be a function of government. It may be a function of the media, but I think it's also a function of choice. People get locked down into solids, and they get locked down into scarcity where they're living from paycheck to paycheck or from family vacation to family vacation, or maybe they're just not living at all. They're just getting by. And they don't really think about anything other than their own little world. But once you become aware, once you become awakened, you become sensitive to the plight of the planet and the race mm-hmm. of man. Then, you know, you start getting a fire in your belly about, gee, what can I do about this? Maybe I can buy a car that gets 60 miles to the gallon instead of 12. Maybe I can recycle my trash. Maybe I can stop burning leaves in my backyard. You know, you start taking, you know, common sense steps that cumulatively as a people have great effect and instantaneous effect. But I guess the most frustrating thing, and we'll talk about it a little more in the third hour, is that there is a fair amount of really viable, workable technology that could get us off of shoveling the planet into our gas tanks in very short order
mm-hmm.
and really stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's just motivation. I mean, personally, I mean, I'm a bit of an extreme case because I'm an environmentalist. I spent 20 years planting trees, you know, for 4 to 6 months of the year. I planted 1.3 million trees myself with my own hands, you know, of every kind, pine, you know, cedar, spruce, hemlock, fir, in the mountains of British Columbia, and I've done oil spill cleanup with my own hands. I've worked for helium-3 fusion for a decade, and we failed in that mission, even though we had Nobel Prize-winning signatures. I've done, you know, worked on sustainability, lived in a solar-powered home, and wrote a book about, you know, all the breakthroughs in sustainable technologies today. I ride my bicycle in L.A. whenever I can. I have energy-saving light bulbs, and my fiance, Crystal, is a fanatic about, you know, recycling, and we even reuse our shopping bags when we go to the store and, you know, we go shopping. We just keep using the same paper bags, you know, 20 times before we get another set. There are so many things the individual can do. The energy-saving light bulbs we have everywhere. I have a $25 to $35 energy bill a month in the house. So, I mean, for all these people with these high energy bills, you know, just put energy-saving light bulbs. I mean, if you have 10 lights on in the house for 7 or 8 hours a day, and they're all 100 watts each, you know, that's 1,000 watts burning all the time. That's a lot of energy. That's like a hair dryer going on all day. But if you put energy-saving light bulbs in all your sockets and reduce it to, like, you know, 15 or 20 watts per bulb, then you can have the lights on all day and you're hardly using any energy. So, I mean, things like that really help.
I had somebody tell me that if everybody would take the electronics that sits in their house on standby, like satellite tuners and VCRs and all the electronics that sit on standby 18, maybe 20 hours a day, and turned them off, we could shut off one nuclear power plant in this country.
Yeah, it's called phantom power. At nighttime, when you plug in your computer, your television set, and you're not using it, the plug system and the little, you know, power module on the end of the plug is drawing phantom power, small amounts of power. Everything in the house is doing that. So if you can, I mean, there's people who actually do this who will come to your house and they'll put all of those things on a timer so they go off during your sleeping hours. You can cut your energy bill in half just on phantom power. Forget the energy-saving light bulbs, just phantom power. And then if you add energy-saving lighting on top of that, the amount of electricity we can cut back on from coal, which is the biggest acid rain producer, and nuclear. Nuclear produces a different type of global warming. Even though it doesn't produce greenhouse gases, it produces thermal heat pollution because they're very hot. And that thermal heat pollution gets trapped in the greenhouse environment. So,
yeah, I know. We have one not far from us, and when I drive by it, I'm just amazed at seeing a 30,000-foot plume of steam out of the top of the cooling towers. That beat means we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
How you doing? My name is Joe. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Gerald. Welcome to the program.
Very good. Good discussion you guys have been having. I've been listening, and it's very informative. I pretty much agree to most of what you guys are talking about. It just it seems like we're going to have, like, a big problem as far as trying to fix the environment with, I guess, the people from the New World Order doesn't want us to fix it. So it's going to be a pretty big problem.
Well, you know, I have a tendency to agree with you, Gerald, but in the end and the beginning, it's the consumer that's in control. We're the ones who decide what we buy and when, and really we're the ones who decide what we're going to pay for it. If we decided as a nation to take action, the supplier would have to capitulate, because this entire world operates on supply and demand. And if the demand goes away, the supply has to adapt.
I agree, but there's only one big problem. If you have, like, certain scientists that come up with some sort of a new technology, and these scientists are being threatened to either stop what they're doing or given, you know, being bribed, you know, that's I think that's what's been going on. I think a lot of scientists are either being bribed or they're being threatened to go ahead with their, you know, new discovery or whatever. I would think that eventually there's going to be someone out there that's, you know, not going to take the bribe, or who's going to be protected by someone else so he can go ahead and do what he can. But that's, you know, I don't
that's
know.
That's such a great point you're making. And when you threaten someone's life, that means, and who threatens their life, you have to really look at the Kennedy assassination and Madeleine Brown's testimony, is the energy corporations of the world, because they're
right
in a business. And what's going to happen, according to my, you know, science sources at a very high level, is that energy is going to be so available through these higher forces they're discovering that it's not going to be a commodity anymore. Energy is not going to be something you even sell. It's going to be so available, because there is so much energy in the universe, that even Max Planck, the godfather of quantum physics, found that the void of space was supercharged, was teething with quantum energy, zero-point energy. And that's what we're talking about. They've actually been able to tap into this now. And that means it's the end of oil. It's the end of companies holding us hostage and paying for energy. You don't need an energy-saving light bulb when you have access to infinite energy. You can have your regular lighting working. But the problem is, as the caller is stating, is these scientists get threatened. They'll kill you and your families, and they're paying you to do this research. They want to keep it at a military level because it means that the next generations of aircraft and weapons can be using this technology, and only they benefit from it. But now we're at this point where we all die if we don't transfer this technology that's in our research labs to the consumer right now. And that's what has to happen. It's there right now. And the oil company executives, they die with us. You know, they don't get to stay here because they have more money than us. They're going to die too, and so are their kids. And when they finally get that in their head, that we're in this together, it's just the end of that commodity. It doesn't mean there's not going to be a future commodity. I mean, once you can go to the stars and back, the ability to research minerals and plants and all sorts of things in other planets and other star systems, there's lots of commodities. So space travel will become the commodity itself, and spacecraft. We're going to be living in a new civilization. So you don't sell the energy anymore because it's everywhere. You can tap into it through the discovery of these extended nuclear forces that are beyond the four or five that we know today. And that's what my scientist is talking about. So if that's there now, the question is, why are they holding these guys hostage, these brilliant scientists? And why did he give me this interview? Because I believe the reason he gave me this interview is because they want us to know. It's time to make that to begin that transfer process. And he wants to do it before he dies, this particular scientist, because he's in his 70s now, and he's, I don't know how much longer he's going to live. He has an actual disease right now. And
well, I know,
maybe that's
Gerald,
why he did
one of
can
the
I
things
ask you something else also?
Yeah,
go ahead, Gerald.
Okay, like you were just saying, these scientists are so brilliant and they have this new technology. So right now, that technology is usable right now?
It's usable right now, and they're using it, and he taught it to me personally.
Okay, and at the
because
same
I'm already working in this area myself, and I'm,
right.
According to his data, I am very close to, I actually already have blueprints right now. To
okay, could someone use this technology on their own? Let's say, if it's not going to be a commodity, is this, are they going to use it as a business, or just, here's the technology, everybody in the planet can use it?
It's kind of like this. If you had an appliance like a computer or an electric car,
uh-huh.
You don't need fuel anymore. You sell the car. But then once everybody has the car, the spacecraft, then they can go anywhere they want in the universe, and that's good for business for the future generations because
okay,
that means they might find something on another planet that's going to transform our civilization even more, and that becomes a commodity. So what they're worried about, the oil companies are worried about, well, hey, if we're not in control of the commodity itself, energy, then what do we have to sell people? That's all they're worried about, but that they're thinking from limitation, not from abundance. The universe is abundant, so as soon as you can go to the other star systems, you're going to have more commodities to sell. You're going to discover
yeah.
something new. And they're not thinking like that. They're thinking
well,
inside the box.
Yeah, well,
I
they're also pretty demonic type of people. You're not talking about your ordinary person. You're talking about
they are.
People.
They are demonic people.
Yeah.
Go to Google Video and search Madeline Brown, Lyndon Brook Johnson's, and listen to her. Who
yeah,
killed Kennedy? It's the big oil company. They all got together and they killed him. Just listen to her.
I'm hoping what you're saying is going to happen. But, you know, at the same time...
It has to happen. They know it and we know it. With the sign of the bees dying off and the weather changes, we're not going to live. Like, who's going to be here? Are they going to have a company with BMWs driving around and no food? I mean, we have to do it now.
There are some steps being taken. One of the gaps that I see, now I'm not an inventing scientist of engineering, of energy mm-hmm. products. My expertise is in building manufacturing facilities to bring cars to market. That's what I've done since 1975. But that being said, the car business, the manufacturing business, has taken a lot of hits. We've lost tens of thousands of jobs, which means there are lots and lots of engineers and there are lots and lots of empty manufacturing facilities that need people to work in them. And what I'm trying to do is coordinate state money and available labor and empty buildings to create manufacturing facilities with fast-track abilities to take technologies like David Sarita's and Eddie Sines and these other great scientists, bring their technology to the factory, we mass-produce it, ship it out to the consumer level, and proliferate it so fast that nothing, no one can stand in the way, because the demand for it has never been higher than it is right now.
Yeah, but look at even because what you're saying, you're in the car business, Tesla Motors, go to teslamotors.com, T-S-L-A, motors.com, and you have an electric car that looks like a Ferrari that does over 130 miles an hour, has a 250-mile range, is electric, and then you can recharge it with solar panels. That is what I'm talking about. That's already free energy. It's free once you sell the consumer the commodity, which is the car and the solar panels. The only thing they need to buy from you is batteries every 10 years or so, and batteries are improving on a very rapid rate, even better than hydrogen fuel cells. So if you can do 130 miles an hour in your electric car for 250 miles of charge and recharge it with solar and wind, you already have free energy. You've already obviated the gas station. You don't need the car company anymore. I mean, you don't need the gas company anymore, and even that scares them. They don't want everybody to have these high-powered electric cars that are super fast and beautiful, because that means they can't sell you a commodity every day, every week, which is called gasoline. So
I just have a quick question. Can I follow up with that? What about as far as the price of it? Is it? It seems like they're
Well, price
expensive.
Comes down just like cell phones. The first cell phones that came out were huge, and they were, you know, your phone bill was thousands of dollars a month, and only the rich could afford it.
Eventually
the price will come down
when
the volume goes up.
Right.
It's going to come way down.
Right.
See the movie Who Killed the Electric Car? I mean,
that's the whole idea, is to get the volume up to a point where the consumer can afford it. I mean, the consumer's not going to buy a $130,000 car, but he'll buy a $13,000 car.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it takes. It takes mass production to get those kinds of things out.
Yeah, but that means right now the Tesla Motors car is over $100,000, but their next one is going to be $40,000 from what I hear, if people, you know, demand it, the other car companies are going to go, wait a minute, this is what they want, so we're going to have to start making it. And that means they jump on board and they compete with Tesla Motors, because Tesla Motors is taking the initiative. And Tesla Motors was founded by the founder of Google and PayPal. I mean, these are a great bunch of guys.
Well capitalized. They're definitely well capitalized. I mean, what would be wrong with just taking, say, a Toyota Prius and yanking the gasoline engine and generator out of it and dropping an electric source in it and run the same car everyone else has, except you don't have to.
As long as you're recharging it with solar panels or wind or other types of sustainable energy, then you're not contributing to global warming.
Exactly.
And, you know, river pollution and mercury and all of it coming from the power providers. And if you know, Governor Schwarzenegger in California has this million solar roof initiative here. They want 1 million people with solar panels on their roofs. You don't have to have solar power plants sitting out in the desert. Every home can become its own power plant. But that's what you're talking about that's available right now. But in the future, when you're talking about forces that are beyond the four or five known nuclear forces, you're talking about energy sources that are off the chart. You're
talking about
forces that you can go to this other stars with. So first we have to get sustainable. We have to use what we use right now. And even the space station, the International Space Station, uses hydrogen fuel cells, solar panels, and they make their own water with, you know, hydrogen and oxygen. And the shuttle is launched using mostly liquid hydrogen, which is a non-polluting fuel. So if NASA can do it, we can all do it. We can all model our civilization after what they're doing. But they're only using existing proven technology. They're not using the super advanced stuff over at NASA yet. The super advanced stuff is locked up in the defense labs. And they're already using it, the stuff I'm talking about there. And I verified that. And that
project.
The Black Project stuff needs
to
come.
They use the UFO technology.
Yeah, a lot of these UFOs, I am told, are ours, but not all of them. At first, you know, when I interviewed my source, it's like, okay, he's giving me an explanation that says they already have anti-gravity, and some of these silent hovering triangles are ours, but then he confesses that they learned it by reverse engineering crafts, you know, saucer retrievals and those sort of things.
Right.
Yeah. Means that we have everything to gain by taking UFOs seriously. I mean, you look at the recent case at Chicago O'Hare. Look at how the media tries to tell United Airline workers who are loading airplanes all day long. You think these guys don't know what a helicopter is and a Cessna and a Boeing? They know every aircraft by number because they see them all day. When they say they saw a flying saucer, damn it, they saw a flying saucer. You can't have the media say, oh, it's a weather phenomena. If it's a weather phenomena, show me one meteorologist, just
make
one, who has videotape of these weather phenomena, has identified and categorized them, that, yes, this is a flying saucer and it's a weather phenomenon, and here's how we duplicate it, and this is what it is. No meteorologist can tell me that a flying saucer is a known weather phenomena. It's BS, and the media feeds the American people this stuff. It is happening right in front of our eyes.
Look how popular this program has become just because we talk about the paranormal in an open way. How amazing. What kind of market share could a mainstream station like, I don't know, Fox or CBS or NBC or ABC, what kind of market share could they capture if they changed their tact and decided to talk openly and reveal the photography that even their own cameramen have caught around the world? What if they just openly went paranormal? They capture all the market share.
Well, all the.
I agree with you. I mean, the numbers. The numbers on. I was on Fox News Heartland, and I was on Anderson Cooper with Dan Aykroyd when I released Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs last year. And according to the CNN sources told me that there's 2.5 million listeners on Anderson Cooper on CNN. And, you know, the Coast to Coast AM show is, you know, 3 to 5 million, and your show is in the millions of listeners. These people are willing to tune into the radio for 3 hours because they're tired of the material that we're being fed on mainstream media. And I've done radio shows with 20 million listeners on radio. And there's a lot of radio shows that are up in the tens of millions of listeners now. And I think more and more Americans are tuning in to the radio. And there's the intelligence factor as well. I mean, you have to remember who you're talking to. Americans are some of the most educated people in the world. But what they cater to, there's 300 million people in America. If you're only pulling in 2.5 million listeners on CNN, sorry, you're not captivating your audience because...
Yeah, that's less than 1%.
You're talking to the uneducated and some of the educated, but the super educated are insulted by what they're seeing on TV. My grandfather never even watched television during the last 10 years of his life. He didn't even turn it on. You know, you're talking to educated people, even a high school physics class and science class, once you've gone through, you know, all of your regular education before college, you know enough about science to follow me talking about anti-gravity and UFOs. Now, when you try to, I've had the History Channel come to my house and interview me, and I start talking just a little bit of physics, and they're like, oh, no, you got to keep this simple and stupid. For
I had the same thing happen. Can you?
And they tell you that. Like, how stupid do you think Americans are? These are some of the smartest people in the world. We're the ones who invented, you know, airplanes. We're the ones who invented, you know, the F-wing fighters and fighter jets. We're the ones who invented the computer. You know, the telephone. Alexander Graham Bell was Canadian. You look at Tesla. You look at Edison. It's all invented here. So who do you think we are? We're not stupid people. We're the people who changed the world.
You look at the documentary shows. Look at Discovery. Look at National Geographic. Look at science. Look at sci-fi. We are very demanding people when it comes to credibility in our documentaries. And those cable channels run 24 hours a day, and they are among the most popular channels because people like learning. They like being challenged.
They like to learn,
When it comes to UFOs and ETs and UFO technology, we don't want to hear the same old crap. We want to see what the technology is capable of doing. Show us faster than speed of light. Show us a craft or a building or a chunk of iron that's being lifted with anti-gravity technology. We want to see it.
You want to see it. It's in my film, From Here to Andromeda. If you go to fromheretoandromeda.com, I'm going to have new trailers up in about 2 weeks. The film is coming out in about 3 or 4 weeks. I mean, we're almost there.
I got to get with you. I got to get you hooked up with Tanya because she's got 1,200 screens if she could put that into.
Yeah, that would be great.
That would give you major exposure right there.
Yeah, yeah, that would be. A lot of theaters are going digital now, so you just give them a digital tape and they, because this film is in high definition, folks. It's not.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's beautiful quality. The quality of the graphics, and the interviews, and the level of credibility of the interviews. What I do is I see what I found over the years. Even when I did Evidence: The Case for NASA UFOs, I started out as a book over 6 years in my spare time. I was working for a small defense contractor in landmine and bomb detection, and I found that scientists love to talk. And everyone always goes to the administrators and the political people at NASA and ask them about UFOs, but I go to the scientists, and I found these guys love to talk. And once you get them talking and you know how to talk science, which isn't really that hard, you find all kinds of stuff that these guys,
and nobody knows
about them. So what you're going to see in my film is you're going to see that translation from a lot of what's going on at a research level, but also in my book, Singularity, which was my lecture at the Conscious Life Expo where you and I met, Brooke, is the most advanced possibility for space travel. Singularity is something so far beyond wormhole, it's going to put wormhole in an obsolete status.
Yep,
wormholes.
That's what we're going to talk about. Our last hour, we're going to talk about that singularity.
Yeah, let's talk about singularity in the last hour in my new book.
All right. Hey, Gerald, are you still on the line?
Yeah, I'm still on the line. I just wanted to ask you one quick question about your exposition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So you're getting a certain amount of people, and you're going to get on a ship, which is like in Russia, I guess?
Right.
Okay, and what you're supposed to be going, you're trying to find, the Hollow Earth in a certain location. Now, these guys are giving you restrictions as far as what you could bring and what you can't?
Well, that's not the way I read it yet. What they did is they came to us and said, you've got to register whatever equipment you're going to bring. We need the serial number and the model number 12 months in advance before you can put it on the ship. So that pretty much shot us in the
foot. What about, like, weapons?
Oh, we can't bring any weapons, of course not.
Yeah, but you don't know what you're getting involved with.
There won't be any weapons on the ship. This ship.
Well, then you put your life... You know, I mean, you're going in an expedition, which you're technically going blind. You don't know what's going to be
so.
Over there.
But maybe so. But there, those that are with us are more than those that are against us. We've been invited, Gerald. I'm going to go, and we're going to have live satellite feed from that ship. If anything hairy happens, it's going to go worldwide instantly.
I hope so. I hope you don't get cut off. You know, I mean... My opinion, I wouldn't go there unless I'm fully loaded with a lot of stuff. That's just me, you know. I don't trust so many people, you know.
Our defense is going to be a higher consciousness. I think it's going to work out for us.
I hope you're right. You know, I don't know. It seems kind of weird. Like,
well, this ship is 450 feet long. It's 23,000 tons. It has 75,000 horsepower. It is the largest... fastest icebreaker in the world. It can do 24 knots through open sea. I doubt anything is going to follow us.
Well, I'm saying when you get to the location you're going to, what's going to be there?
Well, that's a good
question.
Yeah,
you're going to go there, you're going to get to where you go, and then all of a sudden you got something that you don't want to see.
We're going to shoot 3,000 hours of film while we're there, so whatever it is, it's going to be on film.
Oh, I hope so. I hope everything goes well with you guys, you know.
Well, me too. I have, you know, I won't say I have good feelings about it. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be a challenge. It's definitely going to be an expedition that's going to change the world.
Okay. That's great.
And I want you to stay tuned in while we do that. And I appreciate the call, Gerald. You can call back anytime you want.
Sure. Okay. You guys are doing a great job.
All right. Thanks.
Okay. Take care.
You too. All right. Well, you know, we've had the strangest stuff happen in the last week. We've had record temperatures in Phoenix, and at the same time, we had a freak snowstorm in the Northeast. So it's like weather is doing the craziest things. It's hard to understand. It's hard to follow. One record set on one end of the nation and another record set on the other end of the nation. What's going on, do you think?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. You know, we're getting into our global. I mean, last summer, I mean, in California, it was so hot I had to get out of L.A. I mean, it was just brutal here. And, you know, combination of the temperatures and the smog and the pollution, it was brutal. And where we did, my girlfriend and I went up to Big Bear, and we went swimming in this stream right on the side of, you know, the winding highway to Big Bear, just to cool off. And what you see in the streams is trash. I mean, McDonald's, beer cans, broken glass, people's lunches, right in the water.
Oh,
and,
man.
And then when I looked at that, I almost wanted to cry. I thought, you know, who teaches their children to do this? I mean, is this what you think of your meal every day and your Mother Nature, who gives you every good thing you get? This is what you think of her? It's like throwing trash on your own mother or your grandmother. That's what it looked like to me. And I started picking stuff up, and I looked, and everywhere we could look, it was everywhere on the side of the road, you know, in the river itself and on the side of the banks of the river. And you see these families going down there bringing in their McDonald's and their Taco Bell stuff, and they just leave it there.
That made me
feel like, no, I don't think we're going to make it.
Yeah,
I think the numbers of people in the world who are conscious enough to even care is probably definitely less than 10%, and could be even less than 1%. I mean, if you look at the numbers on sustainability globally, we're using 0.07% sustainable energy on the planet.
Oh, yeah.
Not even 1%.
And
so right now,
opinion,
it's not looking
in your
very
opinion,
good.
That's affecting the weather.
It affects the weather because our actions are not sustainable, meaning that we're not using technology that's not harming part of the ecosystem. Because on top of global warming, you have sewage pollution, and sewage pollution is worse than global warming. We're dumping raw sewage and mercury. In the Mediterranean, they dump several thousand tons of mercury per year. Several thousand gallons, sorry, not per ton.
Mercury?
Of mercury mixed in with all the other raw sewage. In Canada, they dump raw sewage into the ocean. In India, they dump raw sewage into the ocean. And the sewage kills the fish. And then it starts to kill the seaweed. And even worse, we get 70% of our oxygen from seaweed. So if you kill all the seaweed, there's no more oxygen on the planet. You only have our forests produce roughly a third, 30% of the oxygen is from, you know, forests and swamps, but the seaweed is the big one. So you pollute your oceans by dumping sewage right into it, and then we're finished. We're finished on that. We're finished on global warming. We're finished on so many different fronts, and we've done it in just 100 years. So
it's going to take a complete mindset change. I know. When I was working on my thesis, I was funded by the oil and gas industry. My technology, ground probing radar, was designed to find wildcat oil fields and to go back over oil fields that were drilled some 50 years ago and reevaluate them for further work. While I was doing this exploration, I went into an area of southern Tennessee, northern Tennessee. And I came into a valley where there was an old drilling office, and we went into the office, and on the wall was a black and white photograph from the 40s where they had drilled into a oil reservoir that was some 1,200 feet down, and they hit a gusher and it got away from them. It filled this entire valley with oil waist deep.
Oh,
it showed hundreds of men out in this valley trying to get a wellhead and pipes down onto this gusher to try to shut it off. They finally got it. It slowed down enough where they get some metal on it and got it valved off. Then they pulled trucks, and the series of these photographs, I don't know if they made in the newspapers or what, but they had oil trucks and pumps with hoses laying down off the levees all the way around this valley, and they literally pumped the valley dry by just pumping it up off the ground. Well, that was 40 years ago. Now that valley's full of corn and tobacco and all these kinds of crops that are growing in there, and I dug down in the soil myself with a shovel. It was as clean as any sand you'd find on any beach. 50 years of rain and sunshine and bacteria working on that oil cleaned up that area, and that was a horrible spill. I mean, whole companies would have gone to jail if that happened these days. Mm-hmm. So the planet is able to rebound, and I'm thinking that now maybe we're a little more ecologically conscious than we were 50 years ago. 50 years ago, we just threw away everything. It was horrible what we did to the planet. But now there are 10 times as many people as there were. So it's just it's a throwaway society that we have. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you put $500 fines on the signs on the side of the highways. They're still full of trash. You still see people in orange vests picking up sacks of trash every single week along the highway. What's going on?
Actually, when I was in New Mexico in Santa Fe, a couple of years ago, I would go jogging in the morning. I rented a room in a shared house I wanted to spend 2 months there. And the highways were lined with trash. And I decided one morning I couldn't stand looking at it anymore because people throw their whiskey bottles and beer bottles. I cleaned up a full mile on two sides of the highway. And
how big was that mile?
Huge garbage bags full. And then within another week, it was totally full of trash again. So there I was sitting in the hot tubs at Ojo Caliente, near Taos. And I told this police officer, this Mexican police officer, Mexican-American guy, and I told him what was happening. And he laughed, and I said, "Why are you laughing?" And he said, "That's the Mexicans do that to create jobs for themselves to clean up the trash. Minimum wage jobs." And I said, that's terrible for tourism because people who want to come to your state are going to see trash everywhere and they're never going to come back. So you're actually losing your economy because it's so ugly. I mean, that you go along the sides of the highways and you see trash everywhere. They're doing it on purpose as a job creation thing. And I don't think that's the case everywhere, but that's one of the examples he gave me. Just because they want jobs. They're throwing the trash all over the place. And this was in a rich neighborhood in Santa Fe. I mean, it's just crazy.
One of the consulting jobs I have was for a paper coating plant. And they ran a web of paper 60 inches wide at 20 miles an hour, 24 hours a day. And I enjoyed working there. I helped them fix some problems using up too much coating and fix some tensioning problems and things for them. And then I realized something really terrible. Every square inch of that paper was going to a landfill. Mm-hmm. All this paper was used for packaging. Mm-hmm. You might as well have just run this 60-inch web of paper right off the end of this machine straight into the landfill 24 hours a day.
Junk mail. I mean, I reuse a lot of my envelopes and packaging, the padded envelopes. I reuse it. I don't recycle it. I use it, I send it back to another person to, pad a DVD or a CD. But, I mean, there are so many. I mean, we're doing a lot of good things. I mean, the recycling programs are really good now. There's a lot of good that we're actually doing. But I think what happens is the corporations have to make it easy for the consumer to access and purchase sustainable technologies. And I'll tell you one of the things we do that is the most brutal thing, and it's our own fault. It's similar to what you just said to the caller, that it's the consumer who has all the power. And here's what it is. Look at how much we used to drive in the 1960s. I remember when my stepfather's car hit 100,000 miles. Like, wow, it was a big deal. Over a decade of driving, he hit 100,000 miles, 15 years of driving on his old Volvo. And now people will drive 100,000 miles every 4 years or 3 years. And the question is, why? How does that contribute to global warming? Well, obviously we're driving a lot more, and there's more cars on the road, but here's what it is. A home in Modesto, California, in the late 60s, early 70s, was $22,000, a three-bedroom home.
That's right.
My stepfather, David Cooper, who was a science teacher, when he was working at Thrifty's drugstore as a photo clerk in the East Bay of San Francisco, in Oakland area, in Berkeley, that's where we lived before we moved to Modesto, while going to school, and he raised four boys and my mother, who didn't even have to work, on that salary. And then when he became a school teacher, we bought a house in Modesto. And that house was $22,000. And my mom didn't have to work. But now, because we want in Los Angeles, an average two-bedroom home is $1.2 million. Just a two-bedroom home. three-bedroom homes are 1.3, 1.4 million. Every time a home doubles, that means the wife and the husband have to go to work to pay the mortgage. That means there's no time for the children's story. You've got a, you're on your own, you know, when you're 6 years old. And,
yeah,
you know, when I came home in the 60s to my mom, she was ready for me. She was ready for my brothers because she was there. Now, because we're playing this real estate game, and this is our own game, there's no conspiracy in the banking world here, we decided that we wanted to make money off of a human necessity, a home. I mean, a home cost you $1.3 or $4 million in Los Angeles everywhere. In the San Fernando Valley, they're $800,000 or $900,000. So who has, how do you get that money? You've got to drive more. So
yeah,
because now you've got to both be working. You need two cars instead of one.
Right.
And those two cars got to drive more, you've got to work longer to pay for that mortgage.
Right.
And that means we're going to contribute more greenhouse gases and destroy the planet. And that's our own fault that we're doing that. There's nobody to blame but us.
Well, that's
so real estate has become a monster to the environment.
Well, we ran a little bit long. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about the singularity. Don't go away. This is X Squared Radio with Brooks Agnew and David Sarita. Ancient times, Egypt has expressed an irresistible spiritual magnetism on the hearts of millions of people. Experience 14 magic days in Egypt, exploring Cairo, the pyramids of Giza, and the temple of Dendera and Abydos with Maureen St. Germain. You cannot see it on your own as well as you can with this group. Click on the 14 Magic Days banner at X Squared Radio and join us in Egypt from October 6th through the 20th. Shalimar Productions was created from a vision to bring to Mount Shasta the masters who are out there on the front line helping to awaken a sleeping humanity. From July 12th to August 12th, you can watch this dream unfold through three great conferences, including workshops. Nikhil Ledwin, William Henry, Sherry Faria, David Carmos, as well as David Icke and others will offer you their wisdom and experience. This is just a sample of the life-changing knowledge you can gain by clicking on the Shalimar Productions banner at X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two in the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version.
I have to do a load of white for first class here. Those little sheets that I bought, they're in the orange bag in the bedroom.
Do you think it's possible you've existed for thousands of years?
Do you have enough sheets for him?
The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrew called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible.
When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio.
You own an inkjet printer, right? I used to purchase my replacement inkjet cartridges at a national superstore that will remain unnamed. A few months ago, I replaced the color and black cartridges, and the cost was nearly $80. Well, no more. Now, I purchase all my inkjet cartridge and copier supplies from 123 Inkjets. Now, I pay less than $15 per cartridge, and I got free shipping. Plus, every time I buy, I have a chance at winning a brand new printer. How cool is that? All you have to do is click on the 123 Inkjets banner at X Squared Radio, and you get exactly the same savings. Excellent printer supplies at super savings at 123 Inkjets at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
The spice is vital to space travel.
Well, welcome back, my friends, to the final hour of X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. In here, the results are always positive. Remember, if your radio station isn't carrying all 3 hours of X Squared Radio, make sure to get us the call letters of that radio station. We'll take care of the rest. My guest tonight is David Sarita. I wanted to give you a couple of things here in the news. Last year felt a bit like Armageddon all over again. It began on television. Jericho was first, the sinister snickering of Geiger counters. The ICBMs flaming across the American evening sky. Then came Heroes, in which one of the characters who can paint prophetic images starts depicting New York under nuclear attack. On the latest episode of 24, the terrorists upgraded to A-bombs. At the leading edge of climate pessimism, the prognosis were frankly apocalyptic. Quote, before this century is over, billions of us will die, and the few breeding pairs of people that survive will be in the Arctic, predicted James Lovelock, a renowned environmental scientist. In his book, The Weathermakers, Tim Flannery puts aside his essential optimism for long enough to write, quote, if humans pursue a business-as-usual course for the first half of this century, I believe the collapse of civilization due to climate change becomes inevitable. Some don't buy any of this climate porn, as a UK think tank recently described such talk. Al Gore's movie is BS from the beginning to end, according to Ray Evans, a former Western mining executive. Keep in mind where that came from, and author of the
Lavoisier's group, Nine Facts About Climate Change, 2006. For Evans and many others, man-made climate change panic is a bugaboo, perhaps even a hoax. Well, I can tell you, as long as you're tuned into X Squared Radio, we'll make sure to give you both sides and a little dose of common sense. If time could tell, and we had such time as a commodity, then I would say, wait and see if the Earth doesn't cool down naturally. But if they're right, and the Mayan predictions are accurate, then we may be headed for a point of no return for climatic changes of biblical proportions. So maybe we don't have the time or can take the chances to wait and see. Maybe we should heed the signs that we see and take action as a people. I know live we only have a few hundred thousand listeners on Sunday nights, but over the week we have almost 12 million listeners. We want to turn that into 120 million listeners worldwide, and that means you need to tell a friend that we're talking about common sense here, and what you're about to hear in this hour is going to be technology and a point of view of technology that can change the course of humanity. This third hour, I want you to know that I will not be on the air for the first two Sundays in April. I will be in Tibet. The 15th of April, we will have Don Miguel Ruiz coming on the program, and two mystery guests will be discussing Don Miguel's books and the nature of the human soul. Now, this is part of the series dedicated to kicking off the spirit race. I will be broadcasting from Los Angeles that Sunday on the 15th, as I will have just returned from Tibet. So you just don't know what will come up on that program. Don't miss it. April 15th, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is the intrepid David Sarita. He puts his money where his mouth is. He wears the boots. He handles the shovels. He planted trees, 1.2 or 3 million of them. He shoots films. His heart is where his soul is, one of the few out there that are living his dream. His book, either out or soon to come out, The Singularity, is going to open your mind to new possibilities, not only for the human soul, but for the human race. His new movie, From Here to Andromeda, will open the eyes of the world. He is about to change everything. Welcome back, David. How are you?
Good. I like that introduction.
Singularity
is out. My book Singularity is only available at Lulu, lulu.com/ David Sarita. So it's available now. You can get it download or printed version from Lulu, my distributor. It is not available in bookstores. So you can only get it at lulu.com. So,
all right. We'll have a link to lulu.com on X Squared Radio as well. We want to make sure to get this book in the hands of at least 10 million people before the end of this year.
Yeah, I've got people reading it in Turkey and India, you know, all over the world who just love the book. I mean, I'd love to get millions of readers, because when you actually start to read Singularity, it resonates in your body and in your consciousness. You need to be reading it to vibrate with it, to really see how it affects you. But
the first exposure I had to it, David gave a lecture at the Conscious Life Expo. I think it was in the room next to the one I did on Sunday night. And he packed the room, and he energized the room, but it was only an hour long, and it needed to be about 4 hours long. So I immediately chased him downstairs and said, David, you got to come on X Squared Radio and talk about this for at least another hour. In this hour, we like to kick it up a notch and try to stretch out into the future a little bit. After all, this is where the past meets the future in a simple equation we call X Squared. Let me ask you a question, kind of kick it off a little bit. Do you think the planet upon which we live is alive?
Oh, I do. I believe the planet is a living thing. And, you know, just like if the little atoms or cells in my body start saying, you know, we don't know if David Street is alive or not, but we're a little blood cells in his body, and they're arguing about it. I mean, the planet is definitely alive. And I think we can prove that in physics models in both the quantum world, which is the quantity of the atom and smaller, and also in the astrophysical models, we can prove that it's a living thing. And, yeah, absolutely.
All right. So,
do you think it's alive?
Yeah. You know, the research that I did for the books that I helped co-author, The Ark of Millions of Years, we found irrefutable evidence going back thousands of years that it appears that Earth is made of at least two distinct phases of matter. One is the crunchy stuff that we walk on, that we see, that we drive across, that we sail across, a 3D world. And the other is a higher dimensional, a higher vibrational matter occupying the same space.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I measured this and collected measurements from various scientists, the more I became convinced that it's very similar to the human body. We are just iron and carbon and calcium, occupying this frame that's genetically constructed, but that's not us. We are this higher dimensional, maybe a fourth dimensional being inside this third dimensional frame. We do the thinking, we do the desiring, we do the loving and the crying and the extending and exploring and wondering. We are the spirit that makes up the human being. So if the human is like that and made of two phases of matter, and Earth is made of two phases of matter, maybe it is too a living thing. And it makes a lot of sense.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, even in physics, I mean, I can almost prove the case for reincarnation. Now we can actually prove it thanks to physicist Walter Schempp, who proved a conscious atom. This is actually in my book, Singularity. And what they found is that, we know that light waves or electromagnetism carries information. For example, we're talking right now on the radio, and you can encode the human voice, which is limited to the speed of sound. It's 750 roughly miles per hour at sea level. And you can encode it on a radio wave and send it at the speed of light. So the speed of sound can be packaged on a light wave and travel at the speed of light. And so can pictures, which is what television is. Television is broadcast in the microwave spectrum, part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which travels at the speed of light. So you can take pictures and send them at the speed of light and voices, and then you disentangle them and you broadcast them on a television or a radio receiver. So you're already violating the speed of sound right there with sound waves being encoded on light. But now, Walter Schempp has proven that the atom itself, well, electrons jump shells or change wavelengths. When an electron, which is like, imagine a planet, our planet spinning around the sun, the electron's like a little planet spinning around the proton. The electron spins negative and the proton spins positive. If you can imagine that in your mind, when the electron changes wavelengths or jumps shells, it will move into a closer orbit to the proton, which means it goes into a higher frequency state. And when it does that, it causes the atom to emit photons, light waves. And that's already well known. Niels Bohr's atom of the hydrogen atom actually proved that. Then when the electron will jump to a longer wavelength, which is further away from the proton, which is a greater radial distance or diameter, then the electron, the atom will receive photons from an outside source. And that has been known for a long time. But what has not been known is that when the atoms are doing this, they're sending intelligent information, just like we're talking on the radio, about the atomic structures, about reality around them. And that thought itself can propagate through the space-time medium, through the atmosphere, by transferring its information to the atoms around it. And the atoms are all sharing that information at the speed of light. So what he proves is that atoms are alive. So the planet is made up of atomic structures and atoms, which are all actually intelligent. So what happens is, even in the case recently of the Earth, the sun heating up and consequentially contributing to global warming by transferring the heat from the sun to the Earth, you have to look at the Earth and the sun as a subatomic particle set. What happens when particle waves get in touch with each other is they exchange information, just like the atoms are doing. And if the Earth, imagine all of the mutated frogs and all the dying bees and all the suffering creatures are sending out this suffering signal to the sun and saying, we're all dying here, please help us. Just like if you had a virus in your body your body sends out signals to the brain to produce more white blood cells to fight off the disease. It's kind of like, to me, an autoimmune response. The planet's dying. It's sending off an autoimmune distress signal. The sun receives it because they're in the same, you know, wave-particle relationship, and it has a response. And the response is, I'm going to send you a little more heat to heat things up down there because, you know, we're going to have to get rid of you because you're actually killing all of my life forms that I'm in a relationship
with. A fever response.
It's a response. So what this means is that the planet is intelligent, that we are intelligent, that we are, that we actually are able to communicate at the subatomic, the quantum level. Atoms are talking to each other all the time. They're reading our thoughts and they're sharing our information all over the universe. So Walter Schempp, this was in the 1990s, he actually proved this. He didn't just theorize it. He actually proved it. So that means also that imagine, the, you know, this is another major discovery in quantum physics, that bioorganisms, plants and humans, radiate off what are called biophotons. And biophotons have actual information in them the same way that regular photons do about us. So imagine at the time of death, all of your information about your life as a light wave leaves the body as a light body. And then when it finds a new organism to live in, it transfers all of its information to that new organism. And that's how I would argue the case for reincarnation, that we reincarnate by transforming our sending our information into a new organism. And so if you believe in reincarnation, like, you know, the Hindus and the Buddhists do, which puts you at, you know, one and a third billion people, then that means because you're coming back here, and if you don't fix your planet now, you don't have anywhere else to go. You can't go back to your planet because it's gone. There's no more bodies there. It's kind of like the ultimate got milk commercial is how I describe it. You want some milk, you want some cookies and the salad, and you want a steak or whatever you like, a relationship, but you can't have one, sorry, because there's no more bodies because you killed it in your last incarnation. And reincarnation makes us more responsible. Whereas, you know, for example, I consider myself Christian mystics, and for Christians, there is the revelation, the second coming of Jesus Christ, and then there's a new heaven and a new earth at the end of the whole cycle. And most Christians do not believe in reincarnation. However, I look at the data first. I look at the science first before I look at the belief structure. And I think that I believe in reincarnation. I think it's actually happening. And that means that we are responsible.
Well, let me submit a couple things to you. One about, we talked about entangled particles. The reading that I've done, and I've never actually done this experiment, but my brother, who's chairman of physiology at Johns Hopkins, assures me that it is repeatable. This theory of entanglement, entangled energy, entangled particles, particles can be separated that have been determined to be entangled by incredible distances. In 1999, it was done, I believe this was, I'm trying to remember, was it Ashton or Aston? I can't remember the name of the scientist that actually performed the experiment, but separated the particles by 11 kilometers. One particle was electromagnetically respun, that is to say its spin was reversed, which we can do. Instantaneously, the other particle, 11 kilometers away, reversed spin at exactly the same time. Now,
yeah, that's action at a distance, Einstein's spooky action at a distance. And
right,
singularity is the only way to solve the riddle. And
right.
what is singularity is the subject of my book, is an enormous, enormous undertaking. Those were the first discoveries that there was something, because when we want to send information now, communication with a distant source, we can only send it through radio and TV at the speed of light, which is too slow.
Right. Right.
It's not truly instantaneous. And the case you're describing is instantaneous communication, and the question is, how are they obviating the speed of light problem, which is too slow, and communicating instantaneously? And that's what singularity starts to uncover. What actually are they communicating through? And
right.
Some of the first experiments were done by psychologists where they took an EEG and connected it to the brain of a mother and a baby rabbit. They separate them by great distances, like you just described. They pinprick the baby rabbit with a needle, and the mother responds instantaneously, measured on an atomic clock, not at the speed of light, but instantaneously. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance because it violated all of the laws of physics. He didn't know how they were communicating instantaneously and how and why. So later, a physicist named Alain Aspect in France decides to do the same thing with an atomic pair of electron anti-electrons. He separates...
That was the name I was trying to remember.
Yeah, he separates an electron anti-electron pair. This was done in the 1980s. And it was big news in the physics community. And what he does is the same thing as the mother and the baby rabbit. He separates them by several miles, even thousands of miles. They duplicated it. And when he alters the wave functions of one of the electron anti-electron pairs, the other one, over any distance, responds instantaneously.
Right.
And that means that it's duplicated again and again and again, that they are communicating through something that is not faster than the speed of light, that is instantaneous. And if you could find out what that something is and how it works, you could one day send the human voice through it. You could possibly... The reason at SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, the reason we're not seeing intelligent signals in radio waves is because they're traveling at the speed of light. It's too slow. If you want to communicate with another star system or the Andromeda Galaxy, you have to be able to do it in real time, and real time means right now. And unfortunately, light does not even give us a real-time picture of our local reality, let alone distant stars and galaxies. We're seeing everything in this kind of time warp. And I believe what is at the root cause of why we can't access singularity, which is instantaneous movement of information, and ultimately the instantaneous movement of a spacecraft or a person or a pilot over any distance in zero time. And even wormholes, before we get into singularity, wormholes are probably one of the most ridiculous things I've ever studied as far as the theory of how to move, you know, an object through great distances in the fabric of space. And the problem with wormholes, according to Kip Thorne, who wrote Black Holes and Time Warps at Caltech, is that to make a wormhole big enough just to fit a quarter through, the funnel, the only big enough to fit a quarter through, not a human being, requires the negative energy deficit of 100 million suns for a total solar year. There's approximately 100 million suns in the Milky Way galaxy, our galaxy, and that number changes constantly. And that means the negative energy deficit of every sun in our entire galaxy for a whole year, just to move a quarter through a wormhole to fold the fabric of space-time so that you can create a shortcut, Einstein-Rosenbridge wormhole. And no civilization, I argue, is ever going to get anywhere near those levels of energy. They're not going to be able to do it, and that's not how they're doing it.
I agree.
So, the question is, what is this spooky action at a distance experiment that Einstein did, and what is the experiment that Alain Aspect proved? What it proves is science is on the precipice of an instantaneous possibility of movement of information and actually instantaneous movement of a person through space. And the question is, how do you do that? To understand the answer, you have to kind of go through a long series of sets. And what I started to do in looking for my answer is, first thing is you have to understand inertia and the cause of inertia. And then you have to, once you understand what inertia is, you have to understand the evolution of human movement through travel, through the modes of travel. So I think the first thing to do is describe inertia, and then look at the modes of transportation we do use, and then we'll slowly get to the root cause of inertia itself.
Well, the second thing I want to submit to you before you define inertia is that if there are entangled particles, and not all particles are entangled, but certainly they can be identified eventually,
mm-hmm.
it means that, in my mind, they have a common source. Maybe they came from the same supernova, or maybe they came from the original Big Bang. I don't really know the source, but... If these particles are in fact entangled and they get into, say, the soil and they go up into, say, a carrot and we eat the carrot, then the entangled particle is inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore humans and maybe even particles in other parts of the universe or other parts of our galaxy are also entangled with us.
Mm-hmm.
Then it is just as you say, that the bees that are sending out, hey, we're dying here, or people sending out, gee, we're miserable here, we're being oppressed, or,
mm-hmm.
gee, we would really like to explore the universe. We're really stretching ourselves out here trying to find our purpose in life. Or we're stretching out with immense feelings of love. Those also have their effects in the universe.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a great question, because thanks for pointing that out, because I've never thought of that our atoms may be intertangled with atoms in distant parts of the universe, and that means they can communicate instantaneously with each other already, and not that we have to create that reality, that it's already there. I've never thought of that, and that is a brilliant concept to come out of singularity. But and I think that's a probability of how distant sources are understanding what's happening to us right now. But the first thing we have to do is identify what singularity is so that we can access it and use it as a tool. In the end, what I was doing is I was frustrated with the problem of inertia and how to overcome it, and how to go faster than the speed of light became the greatest challenge for me, because it was really hard to prove not Einstein wrong, but to prove that Einstein, as he understood it, was that light in its, I should correct him, light in its current state cannot travel faster than the speed of light, and mass in its current state cannot travel faster than the speed of light, and the key word is in its current state. And where I started to find answers was a very strange place. It wasn't in science, it was in religion and spirituality.
Uh-huh.
And I started to look at the words of Jesus and Buddha and Krishna, and you start to see this language of what's called singularity that they were pointing to. And there's no more evidence on the singularity in any religion that I've ever found than Jesus Christ. I mean, even though Buddha points to non-dualism, he doesn't point directly at the singularity as often as Jesus does, for example, even in the canonized Gospels and also in the uncanonized Gospels in the Nag Hammadi Library. And one of the things that really, really interests me is that Dan Brown, who's become so famous with the Da Vinci Code, had access to this material, the Apocrypha, the Nag Hammadi Library collection of manuscripts, which were discovered in Egypt in 1945. They were translated at Princeton University in Claremont in California by major university scholars. That he kind of, in his book and in the film, they kind of dismantle Jesus and take him down to the level of just an interesting, charismatic individual, when the opposite is actually evident in the manuscripts themselves, that Jesus is higher, more glorified in the Nag Hammadi Library than he is in the regular Bible. And the reason I started discovering the Nag Hammadi Library is really quite outrageous, and that is that I had a mystical experience during the darkest years of my life, where practicing meditation every day and being an environmentalist for several decades, in the worst hour of my life, when I was literally, practically, hypothermic in my tent, living on the ground on a ranch in my father's property, and flooded by rainstorm, I left my body, and millions of atoms of light glistening like diamonds rushed together and materialized the body of Jesus Christ right in front of me. In a blaze of light, I was knocked to the ground, 1,000 times brighter than the sun. And he started to teach me singularity in person and where to find it in the Gospels, in the manuscripts. I was able to recognize it because I knew what it was, because he was teaching me what singularity is, and that singularity was the answer to how he walked on water, how he defied gravity by walking on water, how he resurrected after the moment of his death, how he produced all the miracles. I mean, it's actually quite easy when you understand how singularity works. And what I was able to do is read these manuscripts and even the teachings of Jesus in the canonized Gospels and recognize the singularity and then find it in the atom itself. And one of the first things is in the Nag Hammadi Library, even what's called the Gospel of Philip, which is amazing because Dan Brown refers to that more than anything else in the Nag Hammadi Library to give evidence that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were together. And
that's right.
It's this famous kiss. It says that he often used to kiss her, often on the, whether it's the mouth or the shoulder, nobody knows because the word is missing. All the other disciples become jealous. But to me, it wasn't the kiss that was the big deal. He kissed her And then it's what he says after the kiss. And if anyone goes to the Gospel of Philip online, you can find this out yourself, because just a few paragraphs later, Jesus said, in this world there is good and evil. Its good things are not good, and its evil things not evil. And then you wonder, why is he saying this after the kiss, and what is he talking about? Evil's not evil, and good isn't good. The reason it became uncanonized is because Jesus, it sounded like, he was saying good isn't even good and evil isn't evil. That means he's supporting evil, right? And what they didn't understand is, if you keep reading, you find out that he's pointing to non-dualism, and that non-dualism was the answer to everything. Singularity was the answer to everything. In the Gospel of Matthew 6:22, which is canonized, he says, "If thine eye becomes single, your whole body will be filled with light." Single. So what was single? And then eventually translators translated single to simple, because they didn't know what he was talking about.
Right.
Well, in the Gospel of Thomas, which is non-canonized, he says the same thing as he said in Matthew 6:22. But he says, in Matthew 6:22, the complete statement is, if thine eye be single, the light of the body is thine eye. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. But if thine eye
Correct.
Be evil, you'll be filled with darkness. So he's not really ending good and evil there, because he's saying if your eye is evil, you'll be filled with darkness. But in Thomas, he says, the light of the body is the eye. If thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. But if thine eye be divided, you will be filled in darkness.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the key in the Gospel of Thomas. It's a correction. There's obviously has been a translation error in the canonized Matthew, because they didn't know what he was talking about. And I think Dan Brown put all the emphasis on the kiss. I put all the emphasis on why did he get everybody's attention by kissing her, because it's about what he was about to say was the secret to everything. I mean, I mean literally everything. So, and in the Nag Hammadi Library, in the Apocryphon of John, another manuscript, he gives the key to where we find this code that is causing the three greatest limitations human beings experience. And I call those three limitations the three great inertias in my book, Singularity. The first great inertia is the fact that we have war on the planet, that we have war in our relationships with each other. Politically, we have, you know, we're polarized everywhere, and I'll explain that later. The second inertia is the fact that we can't move faster than the speed of light, that we're sequestered to this particular tiny little planet in a huge universe. And the third inertia is the fact that we experience old age, disease, and death. Now, if you look in the Nag Hammadi Library, in the Apocryphon of John, after Jesus re-describes the fall from the Garden of Eden, he says that they took him and they threw him to the lowest region of matter. Not the lowest region of the universe, like we're being sequestered on an island somewhere, on a forbidden planet, but the lowest region of matter itself. So what we're going to do here is we're going to look at, is there a code on matter itself that is causing those three limitations, those three great inertias? And there is. And the code is the same on all three inertias. And the first inertia...
Is it related to sacred geometry, like the Merkava?
It is related to a geometry, and it actually is the cause of all geometries. And what it is this thing that he's talking to the disciples after the great kiss on Mary Magdalene's, you know, lip or her shoulder or nobody knows where, when he says, in this world there's good and evil, its good things are not good and its evil things not evil. Jesus told me in person, blazing like 1,000 suns in front of me, and I couldn't stand up as he spoke, and I looked at his face, and I was torrential love and ecstasy pouring into me. And he told me to go back to the Garden of Eden and re-look at it, because he taught me that it was all interpreted incorrectly. God forbade humanity from partaking of the knowledge of good and evil for a very good reason. Because as soon as a person imagine initially that your soul is living in a state of oneness or singularity. There is no duality. There is no conflict. There's peace everywhere. But as soon as you ingest good and evil, the forbidden fruit, God said, if you ever eat this knowledge, you will die. You will actually die. And the first verse of the Gospel of Thomas is, whoever understands the sayings of these teachings will not experience death. And what he talks about more in the Gospel of Thomas more than anything is singularity. And I'm going to show people how this knowledge causes war, causes us to not be able to physically move faster than the speed of light and causes us to age, to die, just as God actually predicted. So if you look at good and evil in its entirety, you can't separate the two of them. We partook of the knowledge of good and evil. We ingested a conflict. Good and evil is a conflict, and that's all it is. It will never become anything else. And what happens is theologians actually inadvertently take the side of the serpent, because the serpent is the one who tempted Eve and Adam to partake of this forbidden knowledge. And what the way they do that is they actually define good and they define evil. God said never take in this knowledge, period. But as soon as you define good and evil egotistically as a single person, the problem is if there's only one person on the planet, you don't seem to understand what's wrong with it. Oh, this is good and this is bad. The problem is there are 6.5 billion people who have taken in the knowledge of good and evil, and they all define it sometimes slightly differently than their neighbor and sometimes very, almost polar opposite to their neighbor. And that means we argue about what is good and what is evil. And actually we cause evil, which is life-taking force, by arguing with our neighbor to the point that we actually kill them. And that's what we do. A single religion becomes divided hundreds of times and has all these different schools that fight with each other, and the Catholics and the Protestants in Ireland, you know, they're bombing each other, and the Irish Republican Army and IRA and the Sinn Féin. I mean, there are so many examples in history where a single religion becomes divided against itself because of this poisonous knowledge. One side actually believes their version of good and evil is better than the other. And then a single religion, like, for example, Islam, they say there is no God but Allah. There's only one true God. Well, the one true God really is singularity, because that's what Jesus is constantly referring to in all of the teachings. And even God in the Old Testament says that if you ever take in this knowledge of duality, good and evil, you will die. God is basically saying there is one true God. But we egoify God, and we put it on our version of good, and we hold that against another thought form and says our version of good is correct and yours is wrong. So we go to holy war status with each other. Islam becomes divided, Christianity becomes divided, Judaism becomes divided, and we all start killing each other because we all really believe God is on our side and not on the other side. So what that does is, if we understand the conscious Adam, it's causing the atoms in our body to be in a state of conflict, a state of duality. And that duality causes our atomic structures to age, to actually die and decay, because they're wasting all of their psychic and all of their energy.
So we have,
as God predicts, if you look at our DNA, it's a double strand. It's a dual strand, which is duality, and our DNA is encoded with duality, a code that is causing it to age, causing it to experience old age, disease, and death, because everything in nature, as we perceive it, is trapped in this duality. And this duality causes the first two inertias I described. The first one is war. And remember, Jesus said, if an eye be single, your whole body will be filled with light. And if you end the conflict internally over good and evil, you become incapable of a violent act, because as an individual, you're now vibrating, all of your atoms are vibrating in singularity. And in singularity,
yeah,
there is no conflict. You're in a true state of peace.
And there's only one singularity, because as we all bring our eye to that level of consciousness, this Christ consciousness, mm-hmm, it is one consciousness, and there's no conflict between us. So
there's no two consciousnesses that are opposed to each other. It's one consciousness.
Right.
And that single consciousness is, now if we go back to the mother and the baby rabbit, and why they communicated with each other instantaneously, because we're now going to solve the third inertia very simply. And that is, how are they communicating instantaneously? Well, they're in a state of love with each other. And a state of love is a state of union where there's no conflict.
Right?
When you love somebody, you're not in conflict with them. If you're in conflict with them and you're killing them and you know, blowing up at them, then you're not in a state of love. I mean, you may even be in a relationship and not be in a state of love with your spouse. But look at the heart of all arguments. I mean, what happens to Cain and Abel, the offspring of Adam and Eve? They have an argument, and one of the brothers kills his own brother. And why do people fight? Because they think they're right and the other guy's wrong. That's the heart of every argument. rather than seeing that we both have different unique perspectives of the same event, or truth or non-truth, rather than saying that, we actually believe our version is correct. It's like a caveman attitude towards knowledge, that good and evil is a conflict, and we really believe our religion or our version of our religion is better than the other one. We kill people in our own religion. Jesus said in the Gospels, if Satan's kingdom be divided, how shall it stand? How shall it stand? Because in a state of duality, you can never, I mean, you're wasting all of your energy in a form of conflict that is going to cause you, even politically, as a political body, even as a nation, if you're divided, you won't stand. As a body politic, you won't stand. As a religion, you won't stand. And this is why we're at war with each other. And the problem with conflict is we're wasting all of our energy on the conflict itself, which means we don't have enough energy to do anything else. And if you look politically, what that means is if you translate energy into money, into a resource, how much money do we spend on the planet blowing each other up and being at war historically?
Well, yeah, the first 2 hours we talked about the mother load of funding for energy and for space exploration comes from the military.
From the military,
yeah,
for defense, because we're afraid of the other. We call the other the enemy.
Yeah.
And my own religion, Christianity, is as guilty as any religion. When I'm saying Islam is at war with each other and other religions, I'm also saying my own religion is guilty of the same thing. We haven't understood Jesus' words for 2,000 years. Singularity. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, because you think, maybe this is just philosophy. How do we show that consciousness may be encoding the atoms in our bodies and the rocks and the stars with the same information, and that code may be preventing us from moving off the planet? Remember, God said we were cast to the lowest region of matter, not the lowest region of the universe. Jesus tells John in a blaze of light after the crucifixion that this is true. So if you look at matter itself, how amazingly mirrored is it to the knowledge of good and evil? It's identical. When you look at just the early discoveries of the atom, all of our bodies and the rocks and the plants are all made of atomic structures, and atoms, a simple hydrogen atom has a proton, positive and a negative electron, which is positive and negative, which is duality, and you go, oh my God, that's identical to my consciousness. So, I mean, how many people in your audience have seen the movie What the Bleep Do We Know? We know from Dr. Emoto's experiments with water that thought can affect a hydrogen and oxygen atomic structure. We know that if you have a negative thought, the water molecules, when you freeze them, will have a chaotic organization to them. And when you have a beautiful thought, they'll have a beautiful organization to them when you examine the water crystals. But we know from Walter Schempp's Conscious Atom that thoughts propagate and shape atomic structures. If consciousness, the question is, what is consciousness encoding the atom with? What is it encoding it with? How are we co-creating our reality, and what is the habitual code? The code is duality. And what we're encoding our atomic structures with is identical to our consciousness. Our consciousness is in good and evil. We are in duality. So therefore, our atoms in our bodies are doing the same thing, because we're telling them to. In fact, at this point, I believe the nuclear bomb exists, and the atomic bomb exists, because the atom is the atom from the Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden. Adam's atom is the same. The atomic structures is the same as the knowledge of good and evil. We're telling it to produce a conflict, and that conflict, the end game of the conflict of the atom, is total annihilation through nuclear weapons, because that's how much conflict is vibrating in our bodies. And I know myself that I have been in arguments in my life. And I know, although I practice meditation every day, I have not perfected singularity. But I know that when I'm in an argument, I lose all of my energy. I lose all of my psychic and my spiritual energy. I'm wasted. It can take me days to recover from a bad argument. And the reason I get into an argument is because I think I'm right. And I'm more obsessed with being right than I am about, trying to see the other person's point of view equal to my own. It's the ego. It's the old ego, you know, fighting each other. So now we're looking at the atoms themselves. Now, what physicists did when they looked at atomic structures on the quantum level, meaning the quantity of the atom and smaller, they found that when you zoom in on an electron, a negative spinning around a proton, the electron is itself is dual-paired. There's an electron-positron or anti-electron. So the electron-anti-electron, which is the positron, is dual-paired. And then when they looked at the proton, they found the proton had an antiproton. And they went deeper into the... And then there's the neutron. Most of the mass in an atom is in the neutron, not in the proton. And the neutron has an antineutron. And then they looked at what is the proton made of, according to Murray Gell-Mann, is it's made of quarks. And all the quarks are dual-paired. And then you find these muons and anti-muons and taus and anti-taus, and everywhere you go, you see a reflection of consciousness. It's all in duality. So then you get into, you know, again, go back to the Apocryphon of John in the Nag Hammadi Library, where Jesus tells John in a blaze of light that we were cast to the lowest region of matter. And is there an equation to the fact that we are sequestered, isolated on a planet, unable to move in a huge universe faster than the speed of light? It's like we're imprisoned here because of why? Because of a code on matter itself. Now, what would happen if you found out that the code on matter was the cause of why we can't move faster than the speed of light?
And that's where maybe we, as individuals, our consciousness is the cause of that effect.
The cause of that effect, and possibly something more terrifying than that, and that is that we do not see the universe in real time. And when I say real time, I mean instantaneously. We cannot see our own sun in real time, meaning we see the light that left from the sun something like, you know, I think it's 8 minutes ago or something like that, 7.5
minutes.
Right,
8.3 minutes. Now, we have about 3 minutes left, so let's see
so,
if we can make...
Well, if we have 3 minutes left, the thing is now, how do we find out that we can build a UFO with a wave generator that transforms all the atoms in the craft itself into singularity? And if we could enter the singularity, which was originally discovered by Paul Dirac, I forgot to mention that, Paul Dirac, who won the Nobel Prize with Erwin Schrodinger, is the first one to discover it. And he said in his own words that if you could become one with it and enter it, you could travel anywhere in the universe in zero time. You could get from here to Andromeda. You could, and then you could see the first real-time picture of our universe, because light, is, as we know it, is not giving us a right-now picture of anything. So that may mean we're living in an alternate isolated universe, an alternate isolated reality, that we're not even seeing the true reality. So the answer is in my book, Singularity. If you read this and you start to vibrate with the consciousness of singularity as you're reading it, you will notice what happens inside of your own consciousness. Things start to change when you're actually physically reading this and vibrating with the words. And I quote various sources in Buddhism and Hinduism as well, and Christianity and Judaism, all different sources, and compare it to the atomic structures to find out, are the words of these great masters identical to what we're discovering in quantum physics? And ultimately, I think we prove scientifically the existence of God. I think that's what happens in the end.
I couldn't agree with you more. And the more I study physics, and I'm just a student of it myself, as you are, the more I'm convinced that God does exist, because his handwriting is in what I'm studying and what I learn.
Yeah,
the marvel
exactly.
of it. It just blows me away.
It's just
right
there.
I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed having you on the program and how disappointed I am we've only had 3 hours. We have to do this again.
Well, let's do it again when From Here to Andromeda comes out in roughly the middle of April. The film will be available.
Yes.
And when that time comes, I'll name all names and disclose everything. And there'll be no secrecy as to who's in the film.
A screening of it that I can come to?
Well, I'm not at the stage where I've organized a screening, but as soon as I do, I'll let you know.
All right. And I'm going to put you in touch with Tanya, and we'll see if we can't get some screens dedicated to breaking this.
Yeah, let's get some screens out there and screen it in theater so people can see this. It's going to be 2.5 to 3 hours long. It's a very long movie like JFK was. But I guarantee you there's not a boring minute in those 3 hours. I don't waste time. I just have too much to say, just like we just did 3 hours on this show. this film is going to be 2.5 to 3 hours long.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it has been my pleasure to have you on the program, and I'll be in touch with you by email, and when I get back from Tibet, I definitely want to catch up with you.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear what happens on your trip. That is fantastic.
I'll be in Los Angeles on the 15th. I have a show to do that afternoon at 3 o'clock.
Well, we should get together. I'll be here.
Yeah.
The 15th of April?
15th of April.
That's roughly when From Hero Andromeda comes out, so I will get you a screen copy on that time.
Excellent. Now we're talking. All right, my friend. You have a great week.
You too.
And my pleasure to have you on the program.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night. All right. This is Brooks Agnew at X Squared Radio. That's definitely one for the Hall of Fame there. We appreciate you staying with us, and I will play my exit. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying peace, Earth Explorers.